Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It is May the 10th of 2017, and we're back on Wednesdays. It's been a weird couple of weeks, but we're back to our usual schedule.
Yeah, we finally got our custody rights settled with Wednesday, so, you know, they get to share us from essentially 7:30 to, like, 9/10-ish, and then the rest of the world gets us the rest of the time, you know.
Yeah. Wednesday doesn't pay very good alimony payments.
It's not very reliable, so no. it's pretty fortunate to get this.
Just checked up somewhere with a beer ball in one hand. I get my 2 hours a week.
I get my 2 hours with those shitheads, and then I don't care anymore.
Here's your $50 for the month.
I'm like, oh, that'd be so great if that's what I actually got. if Wednesdays paid me $50 to stream every week like that.
No, it's just life that gets that.
Oh, life gets my $50. Yeah, that seems fair. That seems about right.
Oh, so how you been other than, you know, dying?
You know, I've been doing pretty good, more or less. I've been using my time being really, really sick to catch up on It's Always Sunny. I now have a pretty good knowledge of that show now.
Oh, great. I'm gonna start a 10th podcast about that one.
Yeah, I'm gonna start my Always Sunny podcast. It's called Dayman, Fighter of the Nightman. And
that's what people were talking about that in the chat room.
Yeah, it's a really dumb song within the show that's basically Charlie's song that's very disturbingly, I don't even want to get into it. It's a weird show and a lot of weird references within it, but it's fun, so that's nice. But yeah, I have essentially just been like laying on the couch, viciously ill, coughing my brains out about the past week straight. Yeah. But I think it's finally ending now.
Being sick does suck. So
I don't usually get sick too bad, but when I do, as I've come to find out more and more as I get older, it hits like a fucking truck.
Yeah. It happens and you're like, oh yeah, now I remember why I don't like this. This is what other people complain about regularly.
And essentially only ever the same thing. It's essentially only ever the like head cold, sore throat, whooping cough kind of like combination.
Yeah.
That's it. I don't ever like, I threw up a little bit, but that was about it. I don't get like flus or, you know, wild things going around or anything like that. But when I get this, it's brutal. Yeah. But hey,
eventually get to the point where you're just like, can it be something that I can like chop off, you know?
Oh, there was definitely a point when I was like awake after taking a thing of NyQuil, sleeping an hour and a half, waking up with a vicious cough and headache, and just being like, you know what? Maybe I'll just throw myself out a window. And like the paramedics, when they're piecing me together, will be like, oh, hey, we could just give you this pill that'll fix you. I mean, fuck, you're already going to be like in your balls to debt to us anyway, so let's just pile this on him. Just like, just do it, motherfucker, just do it.
You could take Cart into the emergency room here, and they're like, all right, what's wrong with him? Oh, he fell out of the window, so he's got, you know, lacerations, got a few broken bones, and a sore throat.
I'm like, a sore throat, guys. tea with honey doesn't work. I tried. I tried every Fakakta version of like home remedy to get rid of sore throats that there was, and nothing did it. After like 6 different kinds of herbal teas with honey and then sucking on a piece of garlic and gargling with salt water.
Salt, yeah.
I almost did Epsom salt and I realized, wait, no, that's a joke Sean used to make about how you'd accidentally kill yourself. Don't do that.
That sounds pretty good right about now though.
Yeah, I'm like, ooh, that sounds pretty nice. Don't have to deal with sore throat anymore.
Sore throats suck. The sickest I've ever felt was when I had a really bad sore throat. Was just absolutely and helplessly miserable. Ended up taking some stuff to knock me out while I was getting better. And ugh, and it was not as bad as some people have had it. So
yeah, I consider myself fortunate now that I'm over the sickness. I believe, according to such visionaries as Kelly Clarkson and others, what hasn't killed me has now made me stronger, and now I'm probably, I assume, because this has been a hellish, like, week plus of sickness, I assume that now I'm powerful enough to fight crime, because this has been pretty bad, and if that didn't kill me, then I'm probably strong enough to at least be, like, under the defenders. Like, I mean, half of their powers is like being super strong, which I probably am at this point. So, pretty stoked about that. I'm going to be in Defenders, Nick. I'm kicking,
I mean, hey, I'd rather have you in there than Danny Rand, so.
I was going to say, like, I'm going to kick out Jessica Jones. It doesn't sound like they want her anyway, but then again, I probably should just kick out Danny Rand, right? Yeah.
Okay. Oh, besides, you can't pull off that leather jacket the way that she does, so.
Please. My ass looks way better in jeans than fucking Jessica Ritter or whatever her name is.
All right. We've got manga to talk about. We've got a lot of manga to talk about. So I think that we should just get into it because we've got all of our regular stuff plus Boruto plus Astra. So let's do it. We're going to start with My Hero Academia, number 136, close at hand. Last time, the meeting of all of the different hero agencies, which included various students, they ended up talking about how, what's it, Aerie, I think, or something like that?
Aerie, yeah.
Yeah. Overhaul's daughter is the source of his plans, and so, of course, Mirio and Izuku were feeling very upset because they could have, you know, basically stopped his entire plan right there by rescuing her, from him. And so they vowed to do that. But they've still kind of got the meeting to go through. Jerk-off hero is just like, all right, well, the kids are all fired up, whatever. They go on talking about how to go about things for a few pages. And there is some disagreement amongst the professional heroes about what to do. Because Tsunade wants everyone to take a very thorough approach to things. He's like, all right, we've got all these organizations that Shio Hasukai is connected to. And so we've got this extensive list. So each of you is going to check out certain groups and locations on your own. And we need to narrow down this list and figure out where we should actually strike. And that's why they've actually gathered so many different heroes together so that they can do this big scouting thing. And Fat Gum is kind of upset about this because, like, this is a really cautious approach, especially for someone who was, you know, a sidekick of All Might doing things like this. You know, Aerie's in trouble and we should try and act immediately. And, Tsunade is trying to explain his reasons for going about this to different questions that get brought up. Gran Torino is trying to kind of get everyone to calm down. And eventually, Aizawa brings up a point of, hey, Tsunade, can't you use your foresight and use your knowledge that you gain from your foresight? You know, that would really help us out in this situation. And Nadai says, okay, well, I can only use my ability once every 24 hours. And I can only view 1 hour of a single person's life each day. And they appear in my mind panel by panel like a flashback. So what I end up seeing is his or her actions and faint glimpses of the surrounding environment. So, and I was like, well, that sounds good. We could use that. And so Nadai's like, well, all right.
Is it? I mean, no, it's actually less useful than even that. Oh, I can only see, like, silhouettes against the whisper in the wind. And it's, is this vague enough for you to not ask me to do things?
No, like, and if I try and use it to gain information, this, like, horrible ugly man, like, dances naked across it, too. Is like, no spoilers! Da, 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 da.
Yeah.
And I've seen that so many times.
No one wants to deal with that, you know, nobody.
No, it's so hairy. Ugh. So, everyone's just like, I don't really get it. Why don't you just fucking use your ability? And Tsunade's like, no, I can't. He doesn't really fully explain everything.
He gives an explanation to it. He basically says that if he sees into their future, he can see their deaths. If he, like, looks too far in, he can essentially see their deaths. And he kind of he doesn't mention it, but he mentions it as though he's seen it before, and Deku kind of realizes he's talking about All Mights. And the implication seems to be he doesn't want to use it to look too far into someone's future because he doesn't want to see someone die again.
So if he's analyzing their success chances, he might find out, no, you die on the mission, so I'm not gonna look at that.
Mm-hmm.
And you do get this also, of course, considering that this part of the story is now largely about Sir Nidai, you know, in the way that it's now largely about Mirio, this one part of the story is, it seems as though this barrier that he's kind of run up against, where he doesn't believe in defying what he has seen with his ability, is kind of one of the big tentpoles, I guess, that's going on in this part of the story. That's one of the big things that the group has to overcome, is defying the fate that he has foreseen. But he's just like, no, don't want to do that. It's scary seeing people die and then not being able to prevent their deaths, which is understandable. So, but that's the end of the meeting. You know, no one's really 100% satisfied with the explanation that he's given, and there's kind of just an awkward silence after he says, sorry, I can't use my ability like that. And they're like, oh, okay, I guess we'll just follow this plan then. So they disperse. Meeting adjourned. And,
Fat Gum's kind of giving him, like, the stink eye. Like, he's just like, well, you're a piece of shit, Nidai.
Is Fat Gum drunk?
I assume so with that face. He's like,
hey, girls, have some candy.
I had a lot of whiskey bonbons, like 70 before I came here. Don't you tell me what to do. I can eat you. I'm going to do it. I'm going to eat you.
Through my stomach.
Yeah, but I'm going to gonna take a nap first. Falls over and just crushes like half the team. Like, no, Fat Gum, wake up! We're trapped in you!
So, the UA students go off and have their own little meeting somewhere, and they kind of trade a bit of information amongst each other. Mirio and Deku have off-panel explained what the hell happened with Eri. And they both look sad and downcast as Aizawa interrupts their meeting. And he says, hey, so I want to talk to you guys about your, ending your work studies. And they're like, "What? Wait, why would you want us to do that?" And he says, look, I was thinking about it, but if I were to cut you off now, it's all but guaranteed that you would leap into action anyway. So I'm going to watch over you. So let's try and do things right this time, Midoriya. He has gotten into trouble quite a bit, hasn't he? How many times has he, like... Because there was the time at the...
I mean, almost every situation.
Almost every arc has, like, something where he just kind of jumps into action when he's not supposed to.
Or he hurts himself too much, essentially, like, in the process of it.
There was the thing with Stain. There were the two different invasions of the class lessons.
Injured himself too much in the school festival.
There was the thing where they went off to rescue Bakugo. So that's at least five times. So, I've always got a bit of a point with this, and, I mean, it's nice to have this moment of him trying to be the responsible senior figure that they've got going on, the one who's, like, actually reliably there all the time, because, you know, you can't just have him go like, no more classes or whatever, no more lessons and all that stuff, because, you know, that's never going to work, so... It's nice to see him being the pragmatic one. It's like a fitting role for Aizawa.
I'm kind of looking forward to it, hoping that there's going to be more to the building of this relationship between them, because even though Aizawa's had his moments and he's been built to be this, you know, significant character, he's still ultimately never, you know, he's always kind of felt overshadowed in his own role by essentially All Might. So it'd be nice to see him kind of build up this idea of being like a strong mentor character to the, you know, the rest of this class here. At least that's the hope. There's a lot of characters who are involved in this mission, so I'm sure not most, if any, really beyond like four or five are really going to get much focus, so. But that would be the hope, and I would like to see some development with his relationship between some of the other classmates.
And, we get, he also provides a little bit of encouragement to Deku. He says, hey, you know, you reached out to Eri at that moment, so I think that you actually gave her hope. So don't be too hard on yourself. You did do some good. which is a nice little sentiment. And from there, we cut away to a conversation that Gran Torino is having with Night Eye. Night Eye accuses him of using Midoriya to try and repair the relationship between he and All Might. And Torino's like, no, I just tried to make it. I just saw an opportunity, so I took it. Did it work? He's like, no, I didn't. Yes, I did. Did it work? And Night Eye just kind of says, I think that they're a lot alike. That part of him I can never understand. The mad zeal that lurks deep within All Might. The boy has that. We cut over to within the Shie Hasekai organization, specifically within Ares' room. And I loved the detail of this before I then looked at the next page and saw, oh, he just kind of said what was implied by the visual. Never mind. Because there's all these, you know, toys surrounding her bed that are a little, they're still inside the box. So it's like, oh, they've given her all these toys and she doesn't feel like playing with them. And then, of course, a guy comes in and is like, we got you all these toys and you haven't played with them.
It's almost as though you're too sad to actually want to play with toys, and we don't understand it because we don't actually understand your heart. We only understand the concept of what little girls would want. And you are a little girl. And we're not doing anything bad to hurt you, I guess, but I can't understand it. So keep buying you new things, but you won't play with them. But hey, it's weird that you don't, right? Wink, wink.
Pat, pat, pat.
Like he starts pointing at us, the readers. Don't you think there's something strange about this? Don't you think that there's something weird about this? Think about it. All these nice toys. She's a little kid. She doesn't want to play with them. Isn't that strange? Maybe she's sad because we don't understand her. We make her do bad things.
Look, we painted rainbows and flowers on her wall, but she's still not happy. Well, we painted them on the wall like little girls have. Why isn't she happy?
We don't get it. We're such nudniks. We don't understand what a kid really wants. We see what we think we know what they want, but we don't actually know. Oh, we're the wacky villains.
I need a haircut.
All right, time to slam your bones to get your blood together into more hero-killing drug bullets.
Stop crying. Come on, I'll get you another toy.
Little kids don't cry, do they? I forget what little kids do now.
How do you stop kids from crying? Do you twist their arm harder?
Aren't you supposed to put WD-40 as an applicator onto them every so often? That's hinges. You know what? I've been mixing little children up with what you're supposed to do with hinges that are rusted and a little bit older.
Maybe she needs a good oil change, I don't know.
That makes sense. I've been putting all these presents to little dolls in front of my door. And it hasn't been playing with them either. So I'm realizing now, maybe that's my quirk. My quirk's to mix up two very unconnected pieces of my mind and just things happen. Oh.
No wonder I want everyone else to lose their quirks. This sucks.
Oh man, now I know why my boss doesn't let me do anything important.
Oh god. And apparently Overhaul thinks the same fucking way, because in a flashback, the guy, you know, is thinking like that Overhaul told him, you know, you should give her something nice like candy. You know, you should become someone that she can trust by giving her candy.
You know, that super trustworthy things that adults do to gain like slow respect with children.
So the guy walks off shortly afterwards, and Aerie is left to think, by herself, and, she thinks of when Deku was holding her, and she thinks, no one has ever reached out to me the way he did. His hand felt so kind.
Oh, credits. I do like the touch of, like, seeing Deku's hand in that spot, because as we've started to realize more and more how much this kid is actively, like, not actively, but slowly destroying himself over the course of his super heroics. And I do like the focus on the idea that he is falling apart. Even that's not the focus of this shot, but it's certainly something you would notice is like, wow, he has like pretty fiendish looking scars already on his hands.
Yeah. Kid's like 15 and he's already got the ridiculous battle scars. But I do like that, you know, that's contrasted with, you know, Aerie could sense his hand, but it's not the fact that it's strong, it's the fact that he has that kindness within him. And that's always been the big thing about Deku, is the fact that he has the heart of a true hero. So, you know, that's something that has kind of been, we've been, over the last several arcs, been shown, like, okay, you know, Deku's got to find this way to fight, and he's also got to learn that he's got to win in order to be a hero. But there should be some emphasis placed on, you know, the reason why All Might chose him, especially in the context of this arc, which is, you know, about the person that Nighteye wanted to be All Might's successor. And this quality is hopefully what is going to end up being the thing that, you know, saves Eri and thus, you know, gives some legitimacy to Deku's claim to be All Might's successor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like this chapter a lot. I actually realized I must have skimmed through last week's chapter way too quickly because I sat here the entire time. I was like, who's this guy with, like, the keyhole shoulder pads? And
why is he such a dick?
Why are you such a dick? And why is Deku and Mirio, like, so motivated and, like, high energy? I was like, oh, I didn't read last week's chapter as closely as I thought.
All right, so let's move on. Fairy Tale.
Fairy Tale, chapter 534, The Vow of the Doors. And to address what some people have been asking or mentioning to us, there was a note put out, I guess, in the most recent volume of Fairy Tale to go out, or maybe it was an interview with the magazine. I can't remember where it was exactly, but it was essentially a statement from Hiro stating that he intends for Fairy Tale to basically continue on basically about two volumes worth of material. He's planning to do two more volumes. There's already a series of chapters that haven't been collected into volumes, so I don't know if he means including those or if he means beyond that. I'm actually thinking the series has longer to go than people are expecting it to, because this week's chapter is title page is continuing that trend of using like one image to show essentially an arc within Fairy Tale. And this is the Tower of Paradise arc. This is way early on in Fairy Tale. It'd be really weird if he like started this and then didn't actually like get to the end of the series with these arcs. So I'm imagining we have actually quite a bit of time still left if he intends to actually go through, because there were a good series of arcs still in between this and the end. So we might have some time, we might not, but Fairy Tale does look to be ending this year, guys, sooner rather than later, and there'll be a lot of stuff to go along with that. But
yep.
In the meantime, in this week's Fairy Tale, I want to call him, is it Gerard or is it Jalel? Like, Jalel,
we still have not settled on this.
I know it's Jalel, but I call him Gerard because I read it originally from the Scanlations, and Gerard is a name, and Jalel
Gerard's
is
a name.
Like, Jalel's just like letters to me. I don't know. But, anyway, Jalel is off floating in the air, basically trying to distract Actalogia from destroying the ship, and he's avoiding being annihilated. However, dodging the attacks isn't simply enough, because Actalogia's power is enough that it is literally just like destroying the earth. He blasts like a wave of energy out, and he like parts the sea like Moses, but it's not in a heroic way. Like, he just destroyed that part of the ocean. Everyone's like, what the fuck? That's ridiculous. This is absurd. And, Jalel even realized, he's like, yeah, I can't just dodge his attacks, because even if I survive, the world won't be able to. Like, it just can't stand this guy's power. Anna is trying to open up the space-time hole. She's just doing this. There's not even, like, magic energy or anything going from her, so it really just looks like she's like, I don't know what to do this, so I'm just gonna do this. Ah, it's not working, guys. Ooh, it's not working. Ah, guys, this is not gonna work. I'm sorry, I don't know how.
Look, I held out two fingers, you know.
Yeah, I sat there doing this for, like, 5 minutes, and nothing worked, so I think we're doomed.
She's charging her special beam cannon is what she's doing, Chris.
Yeah. So we cut over to the Fairy Tale Guild, where Xerath has, he's Super One. He's beaten Natsu. Natsu's on the ground, bleeding. Mavis is unconscious, and he begins his whole big speech. He's like, this world is over, and a new one is about to begin. And he begins the longest 15-foot walk known to man, because he's right outside the doors to Fairy Tale. He's right before he'd reach the doors. And he begins this speech about, like, the doors to Fairy Tale. I shall make them the gateway to my new world, because I guess that's a power I have now, to break the gates anywhere. I need to but connect the guild doors with the space between time. Swing, it's done! And you're like, well, surely he's at the door now. He's had, like, five sentences. No, he's got a while left. The instant time passed. He has the time to explain every fucking moment of this, like, villainous epiphany he's reached, all within the confines of, like, a single step each time. Because he's like, oh, yes, they've used these doors to depart on countless adventures, but I will retain my memories as I go through and remake life, and I will not make the same mistakes. Seb. So, as this is happening, Lucy is still trying to figure out how to, like, rewrite and to basically make it so Natsu doesn't die, and some of the letters start blaring. And she realizes something's happening to him, he's hurt badly, and she thinks that she might be able to rewrite the missing letters.
Huh? But how can you possibly know how to rewrite all of those?
She says, don't worry, I remember them all.
Which is an ability that Lucy has always had, her immaculate memory. She's always had that.
As I sat through this, I was like, isn't it kind of weird that this isn't something being given to Levi? Like,
really?
I was like, you have someone within the guild whose specialty is writing, is magical writings, and...
Yeah, but she's got the hots for Gajio, not for Natsu.
Yeah, so but I feel like you could have still found... I really think Hiro may have just not realized he had nothing for, like, Lucy to do until this point. And he's like, ah, shit, I need to have her do something. Because it really doesn't feel appropriate for her. She's just, like, spontaneously like, I know all of Natsu's all words in his book person, and I will fill in the blanks as they are disappearing. It's like, it just doesn't fit with you at all. Like, it just really feels like this is a thing I need to do to see like I'm important at the end of things. But I guess her doing this somehow... it's because Zaref actually opened the space-time door. Sorry, I got...
Right, he's using it.
Yeah, Zaref has opened the space-time door, and because of it, Anna's like, it looks like it's opening. I mean, my magic...
My finger thing worked, yes!
My magic detected that door's opened again. But the door is visible. So their plan of just, like, sending him through it and him being too dumb to realize it's not going to work. So Jalal says, I'll push him through it, I'll make this sacrifice, I'll do all this... And Zaref has still not gone through this fucking door. He's still not even close to it. He's still, like, 10 feet away. He's milking this shit. Like, nobody's business.
He's just looking around like, Maeve's still unconscious. Natsu's still dead. Step.
It's just like, dude, pick up the fucking pace. You've lived forever. You must have read so many stories where it's like, wow, if this villain just took, it had any amount of hustle, this shit would be over. He'd have totally won. So, what stops him this time, or what keeps him from just going forward, he doesn't have any more evil monologues to do, but instead, Natsu starts talking to him. And he says, that's something Gramps always said. When you make it through those doors, you make a vow. A vow that you're gonna come back. And he gets up and, you know, there's rumbling going on and there's, you know, steam rising off of him. And he's like, make the vow! Swear that you're coming back alive! And I'm like, alright, I guess we like Zaref now? I guess we want Zaref to come back to be friends with the guild at the end of this?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, he's an opponent of Fairy Tail that's all handsome and stuff, so he's gotta stick around now, so.
Yeah, obviously. It does...
He's connected in he's got a romantic interest in Mavis, so that means he's got to survive.
It's still weird to me. So Lucy has done it. Presumably that her rewriting those letters did something to basically bring Natsu back. I guess since he is this book literally at this point, that filling in the blanks, like she like filled in the parts, like it was like he had a health bar and she just like scribbled it in, like and filled it back up. And he's like, I'm healthy now. But it seems that there is a cost to this because Lucy is frozen and we can see like visible veins like coming from her wrist and like going across her body, and she seems to almost be comatose. The implication maybe being that doing this is essentially costing her life, that she can, you know, fill in those blanks, but
pouring her life force in order to, yeah.
Some it's okay though.
We just need Brandish to come back and shrink whatever is killing her, and then yeah. She'll be fine.
She shrinks the fucking book, and they're like, well, now you don't have to worry. Now you're fine. And it's like, God damn it, this isn't how it should work. It's not how it's supposed to work.
Look, now no one can read it because the print's so small.
She's like, look, obviously I shrunk Natsu, so he has a lot less life that you have to put into him, and I made you bigger.
So yeah, I shrunk it so you have to put in less life force as ink, see?
Yeah, she's like, he's like 3/5 of a person now, so proportionally you don't have to put as much
into him. Word choices.
She's like, why? What's wrong with that?
All right, let's compromise on this issue. there's a chapter of Fairy Tale, you know.
As we're getting closer to the end, it's reaching that point where I'm like, I'm either going to be oddly okay with the way things end, or this is going to end on the most, like, glorious friendship clusterfuck bullshit explanation possible. So I'm really pumped up that it's going to be the latter. I hope this is a Mavis
everyone holds their hands.
That, or what was the Guildmaster's name? I'm probably blanking on it.
Makarov.
Makarov teleporting and then just grabbing Makarov out.
I'm on point now.
He's like, I just need to rest. Like punches a building.
Now I'm gonna get really big and punch something.
he one shots Actalogia and everyone just sits there like grumpy catting the entire magazine the rest of the time the series is in it. Like,
He didn't have any magic to absorb because I just got really big and punched him. Oh god. All right. Let's cover, Astra. We had a chapter actually last week, but, Chris was sick. I didn't want him to have to worry about, talking about it. But we're, gonna talk about chapter 30, which is, we get an explanation as to what happened with this, second shuttle that the crew of the Astra found, and, what happened, and, what's her face explained. I haven't learned her name yet, sorry. Explains that, oh yeah, there was a system malfunction. We made an emergency detour to this planet for repairs. We tried to land the Arc 6 so that its solar panels were always in the sunlight, but the rest of the crew went out for supplies one day, attacked by the planet's wildlife, and never came back. I was the only one left. I resorted to the last third of hope I had and went into cryosleep. And, so they're like, all right, well, what were you planning on doing then, Paulina? Like, why did you initially, you know, go out into space and stuff? And she's like, oh, it's hard to remember certain things.
She's like, hold on, there's a space-time door I have to open. It's really tough.
I remember in great detail everything that happened on the planet, but, you know, things like, you know, the entire purpose for why we went out into space.
That's lost to me. Gone. But do you want to know what I had for breakfast yesterday? It was pretty sweet. I remember that. It was really good. I guess it's like 12 years ago, though, at this point. But, hey, yeah, 12 years ago, it's my yesterday.
Did you ever see this one concert, you know, with that one singer? And do you remember the third outfit that he wore? Yeah, I can tell you all about that. But, why were we going into space?
She's like, ask me every top 40 hit from the year 2029. I can tell you that verbatim. I know every one of them. Who remembers why we're going missions?
For some reason.
Yeah, he had a really big resurgence. Weird, because he was like 70 at the time, but man, the nation really wanted Ice Ice Baby back, and they got him. 12 double platinum records. It was a crazy year for Vanilla Ice.
So she kind of changes topics, and she's like, we were surveying planets. Yeah. What was your mission? Why are you guys out here? I mean, you guys are all kind of young and stuff. And they're like, well, we weren't really on a mission. We just kind of found the ship. And we get a very, very brief explanation for how the Grid of the Astra, you know, initially first became stranded. And it is actually, when you think about it, because we've been seeing how things have developed naturally to this point. But when you think about it, you know, when you break it all down, rather ridiculous how everything came to be like this, isn't it?
It's a bit of an oddity. Everything's been a bit of a weird journey for them over the past, like, they're like, yeah, we all got, like, dropped off into space, and we just, like, found this ship, and we've just been, like, jumping back off of random planets, and of all, we barely avoided being killed every time.
Except for that one time we landed on the beach planet. That was pretty nice.
That was pretty dope.
And then it turned out it could cause like somehow like almost planet wide flood. That wasn't so good.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie, I didn't like that part as much, but you know, what are you gonna do?
Also, we found out Luca has boobs. That was a little weird.
So yeah, beach planet, best planet.
Best planet. Anyway, Paulia, she's told, yeah, our ship's kind of fucked too, so we can't actually manage space flight. She's like, oh no! Just faints.
It's like, oh, is this gonna be your thing? Are you just gonna faint when shit gets real?
I mean, I'm really thinking you're not gonna stick around. but it's because she's still fatigued. She's still, of course, not fully recovered from the cryo sleep. And, the rest of the crew, talks amongst themselves. They're thinking, oh yeah, you know, it's, not so good, because of all, you know, we thought that we had kind of discovered a miracle, but yeah, this ship we discovered is still really not good. And, there's a really weird kind of, moment that happens where, God, I always have such a hard time trying to say her name. Never mind. Tan girl.
Fadubba-dubba. Oh, wait, isn't that like Quincy or something like that? Kishi?
Oh, I'm thinking of her sister.
Yeah, Kishimoto? Not like Kishimoto.
This is what you're doing after
not,
hard.
Not Kishimoto. Kishimoto, like a quiche-imoto. It's a kebab. She's actually a cheese-based pastry.
Kittery. She is thinking like, you know, it is actually kind of a crazy coincidence that we actually managed to come across Paulina's ship like this. You know, on the whole planet, we actually managed to do, actually just happen to land right nearby. And Zach says, well, not really when you think about it, because both halves of the planet are completely inhospitable, except for this one ring around it. So the entire surface of the planet that we could have possibly run into them on was limited to just this one ring. And he demonstrates this by cutting apart an orange. So it's like, so we wouldn't have found them on this part of it. We wouldn't have found them on this part of it. We're just left this one ring. And so it's a lot more likely that we could have run into each other. While they're talking about the conditions that led to them landing there, Ares is like, hey, Zach, can I look at your snack? And she's looking at the fact that he's cut it up in this way. And Zach's like, no, this is my orange!
Get away!
That's probably like the most childish he's acted in this entire series at this point. Ares is like, no, I just wanted to borrow it. See, look, I was just thinking, like, the ship can be separated into these sections, right? And so this section of the Astra is broken, and this section of her ship is broken, but this part is fine. So what if we like took this part and moved it over here and they can separate so we can just stick them together? So they kind of come to the conclusion that we came to like weeks ago, but it is at least explained that it's actually going to be really easy to do this because the ship separated into sections. It's kind of like you've got a playset and you just kind of take it apart and reassemble it and mix and match it. So of course they're like, "Hey, we could fix the ship." And the next several pages are just this sequence of them, you know, moving the parts of the ships around, reconnecting them. And, they're like, yeah, I mean, we can do this. It's not going to be incredibly smooth, but, yeah, we're going to make this work. And, Zach says, if I come across anything super complex, I'll ask Paulina, says she's the engineer of the ship. Everything's kind of calmed down. And, he and Tagata, is Tagata, right?
Which one?
The captain.
I don't know.
Aw.
I thought I had it right, for a moment. Help me out here.
It's like, I think it's like Tagata.
I feel like I should remember it because it's like one of the least weird ones out there.
Because it's like Kanata.
There you go, Nick.
Is that it?
I mean, it's on Elise saying it. I assume she's right.
So there you go. And so Kanata and Zach have a little bit of a heart-to-heart conversation while they're together on the bridge after the ships have been assembled. And Kanata says, hey, you know, when we get back home, someday I'm going to have my own ship, and then I'm going to go out into space. And you said you were going to be my pilot, right? And Zach says, well, that's if you get your own ship. Do you I mean, it's going to take a really fucking long time for you to be qualified to become captain. He's like, oh, it'll take me like, what, 7 years? No. No, no one would have their ship by 24. It'll take you probably at least 20. And Zach, you know, he's you know, like, oh, you know, Char said you enjoy students. Zach's like, no, no, fess up, you were wrong. You idiot.
You dumb, you big dumb.
Dumb. In Rebecca's bedroom.
Ooh.
It's,
I like where this is going. Ooh.
Rebecca, who's a super important character.
And only in the series. Only in this series. Other Rebeccas in other series, not as important. Actually, One Piece has an important Rebecca. I guess it's just Black Clover that doesn't have an important Rebecca.
Yunhua, is overseeing her, and, she's kind of passed on, how things are progressing. And, Paulina, not Rebecca.
I was gonna say, I feel like I don't remember her name being Rebecca.
Paulina says, you know, I just kinda realized something. I don't know how long I've been out, but what year is it? And Yunhua says, oh, it's, September of 2063. You were asleep for 12 years. And she's like, 2063. It's 2063? How is that possible? Hasn't anything happened yet? And Yunhua's like, what are you talking about? And, Polly is like, oh, right, the information was never made public. But still, like, something should have happened by now. Like, how could people not know about this? Could the danger have just passed? And she starts to freak out and tear up, and Yunhua's like, what is it? What's wrong? And, Polly is like, okay, well, these children don't know anything, so it's better I don't tell them. And Yunhua leaves her to herself, and Paulina starts to pray, now that she knows what year it is. So, presumably some sort of astronomical event was supposed to have transpired by now, and, nobody knows about it. So, interesting, and, this may end up having to do with, the reason why the kids were stranded in space, maybe.
This does seem like a really big deal. Like, she's hinting at, like, as everyone lived their lives completely unaware of the threat that, you know, never even existed to them, it does sound like there was a pretty big deal going on in her time. And obviously, no one's currently aware of it, but it probably plays some connection to the things that are going on. You know, we kind of, I don't know if we forget about it, but it's never made the forefront of the series that there's this huge conspiracy thing going on in the background of the series that we still haven't gotten many details on.
We've only seen hints about it, like when their parents met up and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Maybe, yeah, I have to imagine maybe this has some connection to that as well. It might not, but it feels like it would be appropriate for this too, since it would be another kind of lingering mystery and things and something to slowly build to that as well. But yeah, that's the chapter.
Interesting chapter. Let's move over to Food Wars. Last time we got Kinokuni's soba dish, which was compared to the girl who leapt through time for some reason. Very strange.
That's great.
It was a weird fucking moment. The soba that leapt through time. Wait, what? What? Why? Why?
Why not, Nick? Why not?
So this chapter is about the presentation of Soma's dish. A cup of possibilities, chapter 213. I still haven't gotten sick of this biased-ass MC announcing stuff. She's just going, ladies and gentlemen, it's that filthy rebel Soma Yukihira Sern. Filthy rebel. Soma presents his dish. And Alice is like, ah, Soma, your dish looks nothing like Soma. And everybody's like, yeah, we know. immediately Ishiki actually has figured out what's going on. It looks like Hayama kind of knows what's going on too, because he's got this very intrigued look on his face within the little jail cell. And, the judges dig into Soma's dish. The MC is immediately like, ah, how badly has that smelly resistor wrecked his noodles? He's filthy and he's smelly. The most fucking elementary school of insults he's thinking of.
How's that big stinky poop head's food? It probably tastes like poop from his poop head. Everyone's like, one, trying to eat. Gross. Two, you're a goddamn adult. I don't care if you're technically a teenager. You're an adult, essentially, at this point. Three,
Yukihira Soma, more like Yukihira Dumma.
Yukihira Poopa, bam, roasted.
Stinkihira Poopa.
Your face does like poop because you're a butthead. Got him. A zombie! Got him!
I'm not a rapper video because all the people in the crowd are like,
oh! Oh yeah, that one dude goes by like, oh! They're losing their shit. One dude in the background just screamed, world star!
The judges definitely seem to be thoroughly enjoying the dish, though. Kinokuni is absolutely shocked by this. She says, but how? And looks over at Soma's prep area and observes that he used thrice milled flour.
It's like this came in and it was like, here you go, Christopher. Here you go. You don't have to pay attention for the next five pages. You're not going to get this. I could be telling you instant bullshit. I could be telling you complete nonsense gibberish, and you're just going to accept it because you don't, one, you don't know to the different. Two, you don't particularly care to the different. All this simply means Soma made a really good dish, and it was tough to do. I'm like, got it. Thanks, brain. Click.
What it essentially boils down to, and I'm going to condense these five pages down as much as I possibly can. He used this technique for preparing the flour so that the buck meat would be ground down to such a point that frying it, the flavor would still be preserved. Because frying almost anything, you're going to corrupt the flavor unless it's got a really strong flavor. He made sure it was strong enough that it didn't. There you go. So he went through great lengths in order to follow his, you know, yakisoba idea, his instant yakisoba idea specifically. So, the judges are like, oh, you know, I mean, hey, the instant noodle is a uniquely Japanese invention, and it's fair to call it a tradition with a history of its own. It's like, that's kind of a weird thing to say, but when you think about it, like, it has been around for a really goddamn long time, and people do heavily associate, you know, stuff like that and ramen with Japan. So, I guess it's kind of the thing where it's like, you know, it's like if you had, like, if you had such a huge market and a long history, even something that's just like, you know, a TV dinner, if enough goes into it, then eventually the process is going to be perfected.
So, no, I mean, there's people who will, I'm sure you could even look it up. I'm sure there's like YouTube channels devoted to it. People who make like kind of a, like, extent purpose in kind of gourmetizing, you know, it's not a word, but making gourmet food out of essentially like, not low quality, but cheap ingredients. Like, you know, it's a very common thing here with like college students eat a lot of, top romaine because it's really cheap. And there's people who will spice that shit up as much as they can. I mean, even my brother used to, I think he would like throw a slice of cheese on top of his before he'd like put it in the oven, put it in the microwave to like put some cheese and flavor into it as well. Like there is definitely an argument to be made that there's a kind of own subculture of that as well. And I'm sure there's a subreddit too for these things that people put far too much work into and make me feel intimidated. I went to the tea subreddit once because I was like, I really want to learn more about tea. And it was too much
to learn about tea, apparently.
I was there. I was like, I don't have time for this. You know what? Fuck it. If this is garbage tea that I'm just making out of like hot water, throw into a tea kettle that's not like the organic super kind or whatever. I don't even care. I don't care if this is like the Starbucks of tea at this point. I don't have this much time and effort. They're like, no, you need to like wring your leaves out individually and call man. I was like, I don't have time. I'm sorry. I'm just going to buy this box of like 30 tea bags for like $7 or whatever. And just, I'm going with this. This just works.
So, and this is a nice way to play up that there is, in addition to a contrast between Ishiki and Kinokuni, a contrast between, you know, Soma and Kinokuni. Kinokuni's got this very traditional background, and Soma's got a much more modern kind of culinary background. You know, the old elites versus the new common, kind of thing. And, we get a flashback after the explanation to a conversation that Ishiki and Soma had, where it's kind of all restating stuff we already know, but then with a punchline at the end, because Ishiki's like, hey, you know, each of the council members has their own specialty, so I would recommend doing like some image training so you can kind of prepare where you're getting into. You know, Kinokuni's expertise is soba noodles. But, you know, I doubt you'll have to worry about someone's exact specialty. And so it'd be like, yeah, I have to have extra rotten luck to know their specialty is the theme. But we cut over to the judges who are enjoying the dish, and they're like, oh, man, it's so tasty. And Ishiki gives this explanation like, yeah, there's this, the added spice of enjoying something delicious with companions. It takes you back to a brighter, younger time. Walking down lamp-lit streets, wrapped up in both the warm scent of soba and fun conversation. It's almost like a night at a summer festival spent in the company of your most precious friends. Beautiful yet fleeting, both the night and the scent of your soba. And we get this image of, you know, like, I think it's the Obon Festival. With, you know, the judges, you know, decked out in kimonos, going through this festival with treats and soba. And it's a really cool visual. And, I like whenever Shokiaki no Soma does this kind of more innocent visual for something as opposed to, it blew their clothes off. It's like, well, no, this is the effect it's having on them, the profound effect that's in the image that it's drawing to mind.
This is essentially what Shokugeki no Soma does to, like, reel you back in after, like, 8 straight pages of explaining buckwheat to you. It's just find a way to connect with you on, like, just a base human level. You don't have to understand the science of this. This is just what it does. And it always does it in these grandiose ways. You most usually associate it with it, the fan service ones. Like, I feel like I'm a ebony mermaid whose just body is nubile and tense to the slightest touch, tingling and it's squirming all over.
Being molested by a merman who is also a bean.
Yeah. It's like, and then sometimes it's like, no, hey, it's like being out on the beach with like all your best friends and like, hey, there's your dog that died at one time. And it's like that nostalgic, heartwarming moment where you're like, I love this dog and I love this steak. It's a pretty great day all around. I like that.
It also kind of really humanized the judges for me when I read this, because the note of like, you know, it's like going out to the festival with some of your most precious friend, and it specifically shows the three judges together. And it's like, well, we don't really know anything about these guys as people, except that, you know, they feel kind of like they know better than everyone else. But to get this idea is like, well, in addition to being judges, they're apparently friends too. That's the implication of this that I get. So it was kind of like, oh, that's kind of nice.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's just a nice kind of majestic scene. I, you know, Food Wars has an amazing artist and, maybe doesn't get enough credit, but it's easy to take this kind of scene for granted, how like exquisite of a shot, this is, you know, an image this is of the 2-page spread.
So, the chapter ends with the judges kind of silently contemplating, and, then one of them says, we have reached a unanimous decision, which I think is kind of cool. They're just, like, all sitting next to each other, not saying anything. You don't even get a shot of them held together. They're all just kind of, like, sitting back. We've reached a decision. But then he goes on to say, but we remain mystified. Why does this dish have a stronger soba flavor than the other? I haven't said which one it is, but, that's, I mean, like we said a while ago, it's like, someone's almost certainly gonna win.
It'd be really, really weird if he didn't, and like, the rest of the series, like, hey, you know what, stranger things have happened, I suppose, but it would be really,
bitch,
really
warmer
weird.
No Soma.
Like, he just has to rely on everyone else to get him through the rest of this. He's like, hey guys, I'll be over here, good luck. Turns out I didn't know buckwheat as well as I did.
What a humbling experience that would be. but that's the end of the chapter. And, I mean, like, I liked the chapter really just for that one visual. It is a very long explanation followed by that one, but I did really like it. So.
It is, yeah. I like the way it ended. It's a simple kind of conclusion. And even though this particular battle hasn't been too intriguing for me, I'm still kind of, like, I'm a little bit on one end, I'm glad to see it coming to an end so we can maybe move on to something a bit more exciting. Or at least something where the stakes are a little bit more up in the air. It'd be really weird for someone to lose in the first round, essentially, so... I'm kind of excited for her to go up against maybe some more significant, not significant, because she is an important member of the council, but a member of the council who we've known a bit more about or has a bit more personality to them. But I'm still kind of glad that this is ending in a satisfying manner, that there's, you know, no shortcuts being taken or anything like that. It's gained its full time to tell this. I think the only oddity to this is that we haven't gotten any real time on Megashima's part of this. Like,
yeah.
We had a little bit of time focusing on Julio or Julia. I can't remember which one it was.
Yeah, Nishiki, yeah.
Yeah, Nishiki. But we haven't anything about Megashima and his opponent.
I'm telling you, man, that braided dude slash girl, whichever it is
baseball
kick his ass.
Yeah, that'd be shocking. Baseball cat person takes off his hat. Oh, but I'm the eaters of worlds, children. I'm Bray Wyatt. Like, oh, man. Man, it seemed like it was going to be cool, but...
What's your specialty cooking? I take you into a spooky house, and then we just have a normal match, man. I put a refrigerator over onto you.
And then I...
I need you in the Mahal to win this contest, man.
Everyone's still excited to see me, but I never do anything.
In order to win matches, I gotta have weird things happen to me. Like, for some reason, while you're cooking, you pick up a TV and it explodes in your face.
They're like, that just sounds like murder. They're like, maybe, maybe not. I really,
While you're in the middle of cooking, I interrupt your presentation by having a creepy child. If you speak to a microphone, that pitches his voice down.
This is a tangent, and I apologize. It's a wrestling tangent, too. So there's a ton of people who are just like, all right, well, I'll skip ahead 10 minutes of this podcast. But in my D&D game I did, the local one, I made a villain based off of Bray Wyatt, and it was essentially a way for me to just be as cryptic and annoying as possible all the time. So I had to ask him, like, hey, you remember this one group? He's like, I'm a man of many names, but I don't behold myself to just one of them. You've come seeking answers, but I have only questions for you about yourself and where we are going, my children. It's like, the group's like, I fucking hate this guy. I'm killing him. I was like, no.
He turns over and starts crab walking towards you.
Oh, I did have a moment where he kissed one of the players on the top of their head after mind controlling them. The one who was like, I want to kill this guy so much. Oh.
And then he spins around in a circle and slams you into the ground for 2 points of damage.
Yeah, well, it didn't actually hurt you too bad. You're actually pretty good.
Oh, man. Anyway. All right. So, Dr. Stone. Z equals 9, Senku versus Tsukasa with a freaking badass color page to start us off. With, Tsukasa's made a giant fucking, it's not really a spear or a sword. It's like a, I'm not sure how to describe the weapon that he's crafted. I guess it could be considered a large short sword, because it's got a very long handle, but a proportionally short blade. Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Last time, Senku and Taiju and Yuzuriha, saw that someone had reacted to an explosion they had actually set off by setting off a smoke signal. Senku decided that they needed to set off their own smoke signal, and despite the risk that it would draw Tsukasa towards them. So the heroes are rushing around trying to get stuff for a smoke signal. He sends Yuzuriha and Taiju out to gather wood while he oversees the fire. Tsukasa, meanwhile, is rushing towards them, and he is thinking to himself, okay, I know Senku is trying to make gunpowder. And he flashes back to the talking about the seashells that happened a few chapters ago, where Senku stopped short of naming the fourth important use of seashells. And Tsukasa's like, he was wary of the threat I posed back then, so he held back. Which means the fourth use for seashells is some kind of science-based weapon!
He's like, I don't have the nerve to tell him the fourth use is for a deodorant supplement. If you don't have deodorant on hand, you just rub it in your armpits and get through the smell.
Or it's like Demolition Man, the seashells in the bathroom.
I haven't seen it, Nick.
Oh.
You know I haven't seen movies.
Yeah, you haven't seen movies before 2005 or something like that. But Tsukasa's like, ah, even from that early on, Senku foresaw a future where he'd need gunpowder to oppose me!
Nick, do you want to try to explain that reference into a terms of a rat race reference? I'll get that. Like when they went to the Hitler Museum thinking it was the Barbie Museum?
Oh my god. It's a weird fucking movie. I've only seen it the one time. Anyhow, Tsukasa comes across Yuzuriha while she's out in her own gathering wood, and he takes her hostage with his spear, sword, thing, weapon, and then takes her to the fire that Senku's overseeing, putting his face really fucking close to the fire, I should say.
He looks like he's in the fire, to be honest.
He's going to, like, either burn his leg or inhale fumes and fall unconscious. One or the other.
Man, wouldn't that be a crazy end for the series? He's like,
we must oppose Tsukasa and the wilds and...
Oh, getting kind of dizzy. I'm getting super lightheaded. 1,000,000,000,000%.
So, Tsukasa has Yuzuriha hostage as he faces off against Senku. And Senku says, ah, once a weapon of science appears, the strongest no longer sits at the top. It looks like you're throwing a tantrum here, Tsukasa. These guys are like, have a conversation which seems to exclusively just be like quips at each other.
They're having a Marvel conversation, which is like, everything that exists between these guys has to be like a sassy back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Something that, you know, the writer had to spend about 5 minutes on each line and then didn't really bother to see if it seemed natural or not.
Mm-hmm.
But, Tsukasa and Senku make their intentions clearly known towards each other. And, Tsukasa says, hey, before I, you know, try and kill you, you should tell me what the revival fluid recipe is. And Senku's like, nah, look, you know, I only think logically about stuff. And look, I don't actually care 1 millimeter about that girl. I don't give 1 millimeter of a fuck about that woman. There are so many women out there, and Tsukasa calls his bluff immediately. He slashes with the blade and cuts really quickly and cuts all of Yuzuriha's hair off, like, at neck level. So, you know, Senku is like, oh, shit, for a second. And Tsukasa's like, come on, I know that you're bluffing here. And he explains that he knows this because you didn't bury Yuzuriha. Your optimal strategy would have been to take the petrified Yuzuriha, bury her somewhere far away so that I couldn't take her hostage. It's a simple enough plan for me to imagine, so there's no way it didn't cross your mind. But you didn't do that. Either for Taiju's sake or for Yuzuriha's, or probably for both of them. So you say you're all about logic and reason, but I know you have friends you care about. And I may have had legions of fans, but no one actually mattered to me. So, it's a cool little speech that he makes, and, you know, I like the way that he cuts to the core of Senku, and it's... I also like the two different types of genius that, you know, we've got kind of playing off of each other in this series.
Hmm.
Kind of an instinctive genius versus a very studied one. But, you know, also the conversation all just kind of makes sense. It's like, oh, yeah, all right, cool. I totally follow that. Man, makes sense. Yeah.
It's I think the weirdest thing about this, and I can't tell if I really like it or if it's just too weird for me, but it's the relationship between Tsukasa and, Senku is still, it's not, like, it almost is like a gentleman's sort of like a tussle. Like, they're mm-hmm. He's not being aggressively, like, crude or glowing. It almost sounds like after this he's still like, hey, so we'll still be friends in this new utopia, right? Like, you just have to be under my foot or whatever. It's still sort of that weird sort of relationship that they have there that's unique, I guess, is the easiest way to put it.
So it's a kind of sort of one-upsmanship type of thing. If Tsukasa is utterly convinced that if he can just make everyone see their place in this new world order that he's got in mind, that everything's gonna just be great. And I also like the touch that, you know, he's taken Yuzuriha hostage, and he doesn't see really a use for her. He sees a use for Senku, but he doesn't care about Yuzuriha, and he's fully willing to kill her. And he knows that Senku doesn't want her to die, so. And there's a cool moment for Yuzuriha after that, because she keeps her calm, and she's just like, oh yeah, you actually did me a favor, because, you know, long hair is going to be a lot harder to look after and stuff. And she even grabs his blade afterwards and holds it up to her neck, and she says, Senku, you can't tell him the revival fluid recipe. Because if he doesn't know it, he can't kill you. And she even says, I don't really matter, but you're the hope for humanity in all this. You cannot be the one to die. It's a cool moment for her. And honestly, like, considering we've seen so very little of her up to this point, it feels like a really big defining moment for her as well.
I'm glad that she's had something. I was going to be really disappointed if it ended up being that she was just used as a hostage in a situation.
Right. So she was like a passive participant.
And she still kind of is. Like, it's still a little bit disappointing to me, but I am glad that she at least has some moment here that gives her something. But even then, it's still not anything really unique for this sort of character. Yeah, she's basically saying, it's okay if I die, you know, but, you know, the same could be said about Rachel in fucking The Dark Knight, and that was still a shit character. So I'm hoping that there's going to be more for Yuzuriha than just what we're being shown thus far. I'm still like holding out my hopes that she has this innate skill that offer everybody that we just haven't.
We need to have her. We need to have her go to 1,000,000,000% the way that the other three characters have.
Yeah, there needs to be some sort of speciality that she will bring to this table after a while, even if it happens to be the most scary. I'm worried it's going to be like you're the ultimate genius and you're the ultimate workhorse and I'm the ultimate like
housewife.
Yeah, housewife, like homebody, like I'm the ultimate mom or whatever.
The ultimate stays in the background and looks pretty. While
I'm the ultimate girlfriend. That's my town. I'm just like, oh man, come on.
Okay.
It made sense. Women generally don't play football. I got it in Die Shield 21, but here you have much less of an excuse.
We need everyone to contribute for the sake of humanity to live.
They're like, oh, but you ladies over there, please, just don't get captured or anything. Just over there.
Honestly, the weirdest moment in this whole scene to me is actually the look that Senku gives her in response to this action, because it's this kind of forced grin / grimace. I can't tell if he's, like, reacting to what she's done or if he's just really trying to hold in that shit.
It does look like he's like trying to hold in like a really bad fart, but like trying to be cool at the same time. Like, oh,
it's okay. It's okay. He can't see my face while I've got the fire behind me. So
he's like, I can't fart, or the fire will ignite my fart, and I'll die. They're like, that's not how science works. How are you this smart? You don't understand. That's not how it works.
Okay, the fumes from earlier might have really messed me up.
Yeah. You know what? I've been breathing a lot of smoke for a while now.
Yeah. But Senku just flat out tells Tsukasa everything from that point. It's like, it's a solution to nitric acid and alcohol. You can experiment on it using like a petrified sparrow's feather. And goes into detail, gives him some tips on how it's going to work. And Yuzuriha is freaking out as he's doing this because she thinks that he's basically giving up his life to save her. But Tsukasa just says, thank you. Now, I have no reason to let you live. I would cut away to Taiju, who hears a bloody scream in the background. He's got a bunch of wood, and then he sees a trio of smoke signals off in the distance. And so he's like, it must be in response to our three explosions, so there is really someone else out there. And he rushes off to the campsite, and we briefly cut to another woman who is portrayed in silhouette.
Two women thus far in the series, one of them already had to find a way in this Stone Age survivalist world to put in stiletto heels.
It's very important that she's taller than all of the statues.
And it's a weird kind of heel too, because it's not like it's you know, fashioned like a stiletto, but there's no heel to it. It's just all platform that gets narrow in towards the middle. I feel like that.
Man, Chris, there's gonna turn out to be some great use for these special weird fucking shoes, and then you're gonna look like you don't know nothing.
It's gonna, I'm gonna be like a big dumb idiot. Like when I pointed out Sintka's stupid roller skate high heels, and everyone was like, no, those have so many uses. There's so many times you'd want a stiletto heel with no wheel on it while you're roller skating.
God. What a stupid series. We cut back to Tsukasa, and he says, if I let you live, you're gonna develop civilization. So, promise me, you won't do that. And Senku's like, no! I want my Doraemon!
I do love how, in that moment, you can see, though, in Tsukasa's face, that he does want this. Like, he does legitimately, innocently, I think, kind of want things to return back to the way they were. It really does seem like they had the perfect situation when it was the, you know, three of them together, and it just so happened Tsukasa also was kind of like a serial killer. So that kind of tore things up. But I do like how you can see sort of a pain in his expression when he's kind of saying, like, please do it so I don't have to kill you. He's not going to use the word please, though.
Some villains are very interesting in that respect, where they, you know, the same kind of craziness that leads them to do bad things is the same thing that prevents them from seeing why there should be consequences for their actions, or prevents them from seeing why things can't be a certain way, why people can't compromise with them. And it is an interesting addition to his character that he's like, all right, I've got no reason to keep you alive, but I kind of like you. But you know, you just have to not, you know, oppose me and things will be cool. And Senku's like, well, of course not. What were you talking about? But there is also a bit where Senku's like, I could just promise you whatever if it would get you to let me live. And then I could just not keep to the promise. And Tsukasa says, no, you're no liar. Not when it comes to science.
I guess so.
So he tries to get him to swear this. And he's like, do that, Senku, and I won't have to kill you. Senku is left kind of staring at him.
Hold on a moment. You already know that he lies about science because he totally lied about having only three things that fucking shishos could be used for. And then being like, oh, wait, no, there was only three. Only three. Yeah, only three.
I don't know. Tsukasa's kind of messed up in the head. But I don't know. I guess he's like going to put his hand on a science booklet and swear on it or something like that. Swear on the origin of species.
Yeah, he's like, here's somehow a DVD copy of the new Bill Nye Saves the World.
Bill.
If you promise on this, he's like, can you get the kids version? I'm not a big fan of like the new ones. A little too political for my taste.
You know, there was controversy over one scene being changed in the Netflix release. Oh yeah, it really shouldn't be all that controversial though, you know, when you think about it, because science changes over the course of 20 years, really. It's just a bunch of people being like, oh, the PC police. Anyway.
He's like, actually, you know what? Can I get the magic school bus instead? You know,
nobody's asked for that to come back. What the hell?
Well, they're bringing it back. And it's like he's putting his hand on Kate McKinnon's gonna be the magic school bus driver. Miss Frizzle. Or Mrs. Frizzle. She wasn't married. Or was she? Oh, now I'm all confused.
Kate McKinnon sounds like fucking ideal casting for that role, though, so.
But I do like in my mind, like Senku's even just like, you know, I write a lot of fan fictions where Bill Nye the Science Guy and Miss Frizzle get together, right? They're pretty spectacular.
It's called Science Rules the Magic School Bus. Taiju.
I'm sorry, this is so filthy, but it's just so funny in my head. As he's going, he's like banging her. That's like in the background, you just do the Bill.
Oh man, that magic school bus is rocking tonight.
Oh god.
Carlos! Hashtag 90s kids. Alright. Taiju senses there's danger. He rushes off to help. That's the end of the chapter. I think that at this point, Dr. Stone and We Never Learn are actually caught up, too.
Yeah, it's...
with Japan.
Well, it's weird, because they're both on Chapter 9, which seems weird to me. Yeah, they're both... These were both Chapter 9s.
Oh, okay.
Unless there weren't two chapters of We Never Learn this week, right?
No, not this week.
Yeah, so it's weird that they're both at
it's not
that.
Actually, it's not... It must not actually be caught up, then, yet, We Never Learn. Wouldn't I thought that it would be because it had two chapters last week during the week off. But it did start 2 weeks ahead of Dr. Stone, so.
Yeah, I had to check that
and
out.
And Dr. Stone actually started running in the magazine first, so that is a fair number of chapters behind what would be from the other. Anyway. It is time for We Never Learn.
Yeah, I just wanted to real quick mention it's Dr. Stone, because I had mentioned a couple times. The things that bother me with it. I still like this chapter a lot. I'm holding on to the idea. I think Inagaki is a really great writer, and I hope that there is more to, Yuzuriya's character than what we're seeing right now, or Yuzuhara, or whatever her name is.
She's gonna take the headband up, and there's gonna be like horns underneath it.
I'm like, huh, I don't know how that science doesn't really explain that at all, but, you know, whatever. Works well enough. Or maybe if she has the headphones on, then she's just like, Neku from, The World Ends With You. That'd be pretty sweet. Alright, sorry. Now let's continue on with We Never Learn. Yep. Can you hear me, Nick?
The call's getting a little glitchy.
Alright. It faded out there for a moment. If you want to continue on, if We Never Learn, we should be good. If not, I can continue on with it.
Yeah, I think I can go through it, I think.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, we're good.
All right. So last time we had, Ogata, taking her midterm test, seeming to manage to scrape by. And so this time it's, following, Fumino and her challenge. And, she seems to have been making great progress in her studies, according to the way that she's reacting and doing practice problems and stuff at home. But, and she realizes that she's got a fever, because she's starting to cough and she's feeling warm. But then she remembers the words of their previous tutor saying like, oh, you know, if they don't pass, then they're going to heat, then, you know, you guys going to have to step down. So she's like, all right, I'm just going to practice a bit more. I'll solve another one and then I'll sleep. One more problem. And of course, she's horribly sick the next day. She's got 101.3 degree Fahrenheit temperature.
I know that feeling, girl.
Yeah. And she's, you know, all this person is sick, in Japan kind of appearance. You know, she's got like a frickin' cold pack strapped around her head. She's got the surgical mask on. She's got a blanket over her and all that stuff. And, so, you know, cause like, man, you're really not doing well. I think that we should talk to the teacher and just schedule a makeup test. And Fumino says, no, we can't do that. On makeup tests, they deduct 20% and
what
it's already going to be.
Fuck?
What the fuck, Japan?
I've never.
Children get sick.
That's so weird and fucked up. They're just like, hey, you can't be there for the test. You lose 20%. You lose 1/5 of your grade.
You lose 2 letter grades.
Just if you can't be there the first day we planned this to happen. I was like, what the fuck?
Jesus Christ. So, Uruka's like, okay, then we'll just have to get you well by tomorrow. Because we'll hold hands and kumbaya your illness out. That's how this works, right?
B. Patanade, I'm sorry, I totally fucked up your name, did bring up an interesting point, though. Her temperature is given in Fahrenheit. Do they use Fahrenheit in Japan? Or is this like a situation where the translation, they like actually translated the Celsius number to Fahrenheit for us American readers? Because if so, that is dope.
I am curious about that. I don't know. Anyway. So, Yuiga is going off in order to help out Fumino, and, he briefly establishes that, Ogata had to, you know, work, and so she's not able to help out. We do get a very brief little panel of Ogata, like, feisting a whole bunch of food onto Yuiga, which is kind of nice. And it's kind of one of the sort of not really focused upon elements of the series, in that Ogata and Fumino actually seem to have a very close relationship because they've been kind of stuck together as the problem students for a while. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to see that little demonstration that one of them really does care about the other. Yuiga shows up at Fumino's place. Turns out she lives in a fucking mansion, basically. Goes inside. We get fan service, because why not? Fumito's, like, got her shirt off, and Iruka's putting, like, a cold cloth to her back, I guess.
I don't know if this is a Japan thing or a female thing, that one of these reasons I just don't get. I was like, I've never remember as, like, a kid, like, being sick and, like, someone being like, all right, take off your shirt, I'm going to wash your back. I don't know. Just never happened for me.
Yeah. Iruka chases Yuiga out after that. Then she steps outside, and Iruka's like, oh, well, you know, I guess you are kind of a boy, so you know, do you want to see that kind of stuff? You want to see, like, naked girls or something? Like, I'm not trying to show you my boobs or anything. Being very subtle about this. And Yuga's like, what are you talking about? I'm not trying to show you my boobs! Fumino is shy because she's not, like, looking her best. Iruka cooks food for them, and she's like, I am actually a good cook! Behold my amazing cooking abilities!
She has a line too that's weird to me. She's like, yee, she's crazy cute! Even to me! Dot, 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 and I'm a girl! Just like,
I talked to you last week, I was like, is she supposed to be bisexual?
I would assume,
like, more and more mounting evidence now!
I assumed that was the inverse there, cause that almost sounds like she's like, well, I'm a girl. I can't find girls cute. Maybe she is like, oh, like, this is her, like, deep-seated thing, and it's just like, yeah, she's like, I've always been afraid of these feelings, I don't want to come out with them. Instead of her just being like, I'm gonna grab your boobs, I'm bored, someone entertain me, bang, 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 like pots and pans, like smashed against the walls.
Iruka has a little fantasy of, like, her caring for Yuiga like a good housewife and stuff, and him being all, like, smooth and sexual with her. And of course, in reality, Yuiga's like, what the fuck are you doing? Why are you freaking out? You know. I don't know. I'm still just not, it's the humor with Iruka in general is still just not connecting with me. Like, there's all these jokes that are thrown out for her, and
she gets a lot of them, and it's still the make it or break it, but I do feel that this chapter went at least a small step towards making her a little bit more likable for me, because at least there's some human element to her beyond I swim and I get bored. Like, having her show that she's, like, a responsible cook and she's going to go out of her way to help her friends, because even though it's been kind of glossed over and I think almost kind of, like, retconned out of it, it was still a point at their early relationship that she didn't have time for these sort of things because she was always practicing swimming. It's been kind of forgotten now because it's like, yeah, she sure has a lot of time to fuck around with Yuiga and whatever he's up to at all times. But it is still that notion that this was probably a time she could have been spending studying or practicing, but she is spending it instead helping out one of the other girls in the study group. And I do like that we are seeing there's a human element to her beyond these things. I just wish we didn't need to get so much of her. Because she's basically been, like, the side girl in every chapter, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that overexposure is really hurting her, honestly. So, Iruka falls asleep. Fumino wakes up. She and Yuiga have a bit of a conversation. She thinks back to a lesson that they were having at an earlier point where she went, math is hard, basically. He explained it as like, hey, you know, maybe you should try and think of this a little differently. Instead of memorizing symbols and formulas, maybe you should try and think of them as words, because, you know, math is a language, the symbols mean different things. So associate a formula with instead a sentence and then use that to figure it out. You know, do math the way math wasn't meant to be done. It kind of pissed me off, but then I was like, whatever. Some people just don't get math. Fine.
I was going to say, look, I can understand why this would be the bad way to go across it, but I do like his way of, I think it's an okay way of trying to explain this to somebody who's really good at humanities and not so great in math, trying to explain that concept to them of think of it like a language and you're just trying to follow along with the parts of it. It's not a perfect explanation. But as somebody who is more versed in English than I was ever in math, it's something that I could appreciate in just that way of like, oh, it's a way to kind of connect the two of them that one side would understand that maybe wouldn't have grasped before.
And it is a legitimate technique. I mean, I think speaking as someone who has always been more of a, you know, science and math kind of guy, than a humanities guy, it does kind of bother me because the entire way that the reason why we have math symbols is because it's a lot less clunky to illustrate the ideas than it is to write them all out. So Femino is essentially doing something to kind of work backwards from the shorthand that's been developed to make things easier to understand when it's written down. But this is a legitimate technique. And definitely some people do run into the same issue that she does, where they look at an equation and are just like, yeah, you know, people have their different specializations. And yes, I do understand that some people look at an equation and are like, what the fuck is this? I don't get it. It looks like gobbledygook. So having her translate, is something that makes sense. There's also a note, part of this, I can't actually tell where the hell the note is referencing, but there is apparently something actually within the chapter that is pulling from an actual, like, university entrance exam, test. So there's like some legitimate stuff behind this, and that is probably the part that's, I think impressed me the most. And it leads into the idea that this series is more than just, you know, the romantic comedy. It is actually about, you know, learning stuff or studying. So. Mm-hmm. But, basically, Femino's like, you know, doing this has really helped me to get less intimidated by math, and so I really appreciate you helping me out with this, and with your help, I'm starting to feel like my dream might actually come true. And Yuiga's like, yeah, that's great and all, but you should lie down. And Femino's like, but I feel better now. Oh, well, yeah, but your shirt's all sweaty and see-through now, and I don't really care about you. Oh, no! Another example of fan service.
Again, it is what it is. What can you do? I guess the only thing I could say is, like, again, at least it's not a situation where Yuega's being a pervert. He is, like, I think the thing I hate the most in these sort of harem series is when the fan service is done the same way of, oh, an unintended situation happens. The main character is not, like, necessarily a pervert, but everyone just assumes he is and starts beating him up and, like, it's, like, wacky comical. Like, you don't understand. I'm not really like that. I just like that Yuega's just like, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to see that. You shart. And, like, the joke's still there. You get the fan service, but that Yuega still, like, comes across the guy who's like, I'm not trying. I can't. This is really weird and uncomfortable for all of us, but I can't. I don't know why this stuff keeps happening, but I'm not. I promise you I'm not.
We cut to the results of the tests. Femino and Ogata basically managed to kind of scrape by a few percentage points. The former tutor is just like, I still don't really get why we're doing this. You know, we're turning our geniuses into ordinary students for some reason, which is a fair point. And everyone, you know, kind of celebrates afterwards. And then it turns out that Yuiga has caught Furashi's cold, and so now he's going to spend time at some sick. Oh, bop, bop, bop. That's it.
Yeah.
It was a pretty all right chapter, though. Minor quibbles aside, I do think that, honestly, the whole... It was nice to have a change of pace from... And then he manages to do something else to just randomly help them out. It's like, no, there's like a logical lesson in there. And it's nice to see that Fumino actually was just making progress and then fucking luck into passing like Okada did last time.
You know what makes me sad, though? So, Yueka catches her cold at the end of it, and I'm like, so wait, is he going to miss the exam? Because then he's going to lose that 20%, and he's not a genius. He has to work for everything. I think he needs that 20%. This sucks.
No. The exams have already passed, because he took them at the same time that Fumino and Ogata did. So he's cool.
I'm still worried that he's going to lose out on it.
Hey. I'm more offended that Fumino did not help to carry him back to health.
Yeah. Skank.
Maybe or you could Aruka, have, for that matter.
Maybe you could have
wouldn't
walked
all about that. Wouldn't Aruka be all over that? It's like, oh, I get to carry you when you get back to health. I'm just like,
yeah, you get to walk in on, and his sweats made his shirt all fucking see-through and transparent.
Oh man, there's like no muscle. Okay.
Oh man, my nips are totally blasting out everywhere. It's like, that's not a phrase that should be uttered. My nips are blasting out everywhere. That's not what the kids say.
All right, episode title. But I know, alright, chapter overall. Alright, I gotta take a drink for this one.
Alright. So, we are now going into the Promised Neverland, chapter 37.
Escape. With, once again, awesome color pages, and this is actually the last chapter of the first arc of the story. And, yeah.
This is a pretty significant one in...
This is a pretty goddamn huge chapter. Let's start off with the first thing. So we, cut to a flashback of Isabella's childhood, mom's childhood. And, where she learns this song from, one of the other people one of the other kids in the compound. And, the kid's name is Leslie. That looks like a boy though.
It's tough to tell, like, because I would assume it's a boy, also based a little bit on the uniform, but I think that the uniforms are, like, interchangeable between the genders. Like, I'm pretty sure, I feel like I've seen females in the current cast who wear pants, so I don't know. I'm not versed.
Boys can be named Leslie. It's just not especially common.
You know? It's just a very androgynous face, and then it's added on to the fact that Japanese, like, drawings feel like are very androgynous in nature. Right. And then when you add a child onto it, to the point where there's no, like, physique to, like, base it off of, you have to sit there and you're like, damn it, this should be an anime so I can go off your voice. And then I'm like, that's not gonna help. I'd assume Goku was a girl every time I heard her if I went off by that. You know what? Whatever. I think it's just super dope seeing Isabella as a kid. Because it's weird. That was so weird seeing her jump down from the tree and being like, you become a monster.
So, Isabella hears Leslie kind of singing a song, which has notes but no lyrics. So, I don't know. But she's like, hey, let me hear some more of that. And she ends up singing along with him. And she narrates to herself, I loved everything. I loved Leslie. I loved the house. And then we get kind of a rapid time progression of her, you know, discovering the pits on the other side of the wall, having the mom motion to her, getting recruited to become a mom herself, going through the training, being a sister.
Whoa, Nick, are we just going to skip over the one demon who clearly works out and wants everyone to know it? Like the one who's super is like, hey guys! Yeah, so, you know, I feel like sleeves are...
I wear the sleeveless shirt, you know, it's totally natural.
Sleeves are optional, really, amongst demons. So, you know, just, you know, I thought I'd get some tan going on these arms. What? No, I work out every so often, not too much. You know, I don't want to... Flash.
So, Isabella, Isabella goes through all the training. She takes the test, she becomes a sister, she bears a child... And, sings, the song that she learned from Leslie, while bearing the child, and, thinks to herself, I was able to stay strong because of that song.
What's the best song that she could be singing? I feel like it's too easy to go with the Sir Mix-a-Lot, but that is funny to me. Like, she's just in, like, her sweet way doing an acoustic version, like, I like big butts and I cannot lie.
Oh, gosh. Hang on.
Or maybe she's doing like Bare Naked Ladies, the one song where it's like, 3 days since I lacked at you. Something, something, the anime girls, Sailor Moon, or whatever, how the song goes. I don't remember it. I know the song. I don't know the lyrics. That's tough.
I know, a lot of options. To get on everybody's nerves.
She's like, this is a song that never ends. Yes, it goes on and on, my friends. And that's
what I'm saying.
Not knowing what it was.
I keep on singing forever.
And that's what, like, Ray's over in the back, because it's a song that never ends.
Just baby like a baby memory, my friend. Oh, spoilers!
All right.
Serious. It's a serious chapter.
We also have, like, 4 series to finish recapping by the end of this.
What the fuck time is it even?
About 9:15.
Oh, fuck. Gotta get going. All right. So Isabel's thinking about to herself, like, the world won't change, and what good would it do if I died? So, in that case, I should do what I can. I should give them all the love they need, extend their lives as much as possible, for these children who don't know anything, and for Leslie, and who isn't around anymore. So, the first part, important part of this chapter is actually kind of learning what Isabella's villainous motivation actually is, which is essentially that she has given up. She has given up resisting the demon. She's given up trying to escape. All that she feels like she can do is just kind of give people as much happiness for as long as possible and then send them off to die.
And
presumably that's why her kids are special, is because she goes to efforts to get them to do as well in the test as possible so that they live as long as possible.
It is, it's very, very sad, as, like, we'll kind of see towards the end of this chapter, but, it's nice to see this, especially because there's not really any sign, like, we don't know yet now what's gonna happen for a lot of people, and Mom's one of them. Like, I know we'd like to say that the same situation will be there for Emma to come back to, but there might very well be a new mom at the facility by the time they get back there.
Considering she's let a lot of kids escape.
She basically is responsible for the biggest, like, monumental fuck-up of this entire facility to our knowledge at this point.
To our knowledge, yeah. Who knows if anyone else managed to get out and it's just been covered up.
Even then, though, that's probably, like, what, 1 or 2 people at most? This is, what, like, 12 kids or something?
Everyone over the age of 4, over the age of 4, yeah. So then we cut to a bit where it's basically the moment where Ray and Isabella kind of first revealed themselves to each other, and with a certain very important detail added, because Ray's singing the song that Isabella has been singing this whole time, and she's like,
song that never ends.
And Isabel just goes, Ray, how do you know that song? And Ray's like, I watch Lamb Chop. You might think it's a children's program.
He's like, oh, you know that song? It's already become too popular now. I'm done with it. As he flips his hipster cloth to the other side of his face.
I have to say, though, this is just, it's a really good moment, actually, because Ray just kind of looks at her, and you get that same scene that you saw earlier of Isabella singing this song to her pregnant belly, and then it cuts back to Isabella's face realizing Ray's her kid. And it's never said, which is great, you know.
Yeah.
It gives you plenty of information, like, you will fucking connect these goddamn dots, but
it doesn't hold your hand the whole way through.
Yeah, and it's, so we had been wondering, hey, you know, Isabella's got a kid. Where are they? Oh, we've known them the whole time.
And that adds to that idea that Crone's kid may be out there, that all of these kids could potentially, I mean, we don't know if there's another way some of these kids get added into the system, but all these kids could potentially be the kids of another caretaker in one of the other facilities, or another mom in training, or what, essentially. And kind of puts a little more context into that particular relationship that Isabella and Ray had.
Mm-hmm. And we get, you know, more justification from Isabella for why she's fell off this path, because as a kid, Ray asked her, "Why did you give birth to me?" And Isabella's answer was, "It was in order for me to survive." And, you know, she flat out kind of admits to herself, "Hey, I was really angry that all this happened, that, you know, my really good friend had been killed, that we were in this situation, but I couldn't do anything, and I wanted to stay alive and not get eaten by them. So, yeah, that's why she did this." And, but she's also kind of, like, just accepted that the kids are getting away. It's like, hey, the children are outside, and the position at the top, the results I've built up are all gone. If I go after them, it's already too late. And, you know, I could have done some things differently, maybe. But, you know, there's no what-ifs when it comes to results. I couldn't see what was going on with them. I lost them. And, yeah.
I had mentioned back when we first got that chapter where we saw inside Mom's mind, I was like, this is a big change because you can never get that back, essentially. And I think it was really effective that we got that first look inside her mind, and now we're getting this essentially all after she had already lost. Like, we got that first flashback or that first look inside her mind as Ray and Emma were enacting their plan, or I guess Emma was enacting a plan. And I feel like this was really effective because we could have potentially gotten peaks of this before all this happened. We could have had some insinuation that Mom had some, like, really tragic kind of reason that brought to us. We always kind of knew that because we know the way these kids grow up and Mom presumably went through the same stuff. But we could have had this flashback. We could have had Leslie's name mentioned before. We could have had that stuff before. But I feel like that would have undermined what Mom was at that time. And it kind of hits so much harder now to know what kind of person Mom was and what kind of things she's been struggling with after the moment's already passed where she can't stop it. There's nothing to change this now. You know,
she's not the opposing force at this point anymore.
There's no reason to give her a mystique anymore. I feel like you would have taken away from it by giving her too much humanity before, but giving that humanity now helps us to better appreciate kind of how she represents almost an alternate end game for Emma. Had things not worked out, that could have been when Emma became. You know, it sounds like she maybe didn't have as much time or as much resources, or maybe just wasn't as smart as, you know, these three kids were and their ability to plan, you know, be resourceful. So it's, but we do get that sense that she was somebody who tried to escape at one point. They show that the mom who was the instructor of her at one point had saw her on top of the wall. So clearly it's something she tried. She was Emma basically at one point in time, but just didn't succeed. And it's nice to kind of get that parallel in this moment.
And Isabella remembers back to when all the kids were much younger, you know, raising them from little babies. And she thinks to herself, they were all so small. I wish I could have just loved them normally. Which, that kind of sums it up for her character. That's that one line, I wish I could have loved them normally.
Because she does, like, that's the thing. You always got that her affection towards the children was genuine. It was just
kind of weird.
Yeah. Well, it was all hidden behind this facade of like, hey, I'm going to raise you up so you can be eaten one day. Sucks for that, but hey, I'm going to make these like 12 years or whatever pretty sweet.
So she's like, all right, well, they're gone. And, she wishes them luck, quietly to herself. She thinks, go on, be careful, and I pray that you can find light. And, she heads back to the remaining children, and, she puts her hand on Phil's head, and she's just like, don't worry, they escaped safely. And Phil's just like, huh? But it's like, Isabel's not as dumb as you think.
I like this a lot too, that she puts the facade down in a way that isn't direct, where she just notes,
you can mean like, oh yeah, they got away from the fire, but.
Yeah, she just says it, don't worry, they escaped safely, so that she eases Phil's conscience on things and puts him at ease before she comforts the rest of the kids.
Yeah. And she starts to sing the song that she used to sing before, And she's thinking to herself still, like, hey, the pursuers haven't caught on yet. They won't imagine the kids are going to escape through the cliff, and I retrieve the ropes. And so she's kind of helping them out in a very small way like this, now that she can't oppose them anymore, and while wishing them luck. And, yeah.
It's very sad. A lot of people in the chat are noting it now, too. This chapter coming out right in time for Mother's Day.
Yeah.
That's pretty brutal, but, I mean, yeah, that it's, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if we're going to see Mom anymore after this. Who knows?
Yeah, but you don't know. I mean, she might, you know, you saw what happened with Crone. She could end up being killed shortly after this, or who knows? Hey, maybe the kids are going to have to rescue Mom at some point.
Maybe.
Is she going to get eaten?
I mean, Grandma.
Or is she just going to be reinstalled in the freaking facility? There's a bunch of different ways they could go about this.
Grandma had a lot of faith in her, but
yeah,
that was before 12 kids or whatever escaped, so who knows?
So is she going to treat it as like, well, the kids are still out there. We can still get them. Or is she going to be like, okay, clearly you're not fit for this, so get in the stomach. You know?
Yeah, the way this ends definitely gives us as readers the like necessary feeling to accept any scenario that happens. If she shows up again, great, but if this is essentially her send-off, there's no way you could be upset with this, because this is a pretty great way of, like, writing this character out as well.
And so we cut to Emma and the escaping kids running outside. Emma is, you know, joyous because they're actually free now, but she does think to herself... Fucking hell. She does think to herself, this isn't it, you know... We're still food in this world. We're still going to be in danger, and it's going to be very different from being in the facility. Freedom is so beautiful, yet it's cruel. And no matter how harsh it is, I'll survive. I'll live with everyone, and I'll definitely go back to retrieve Phil and everyone else. And I was kind of expecting through all these buildups to run through what's like, are they going to come across like a barren landscape at the end of all this and be like, oh shit! No, they get to the edge of a cliff and they see, look out towards this bright horizon. As the rising sun greets them. And yeah, it's just free.
There was definitely real tension as I was reading it. I was like, what happens when they get past this tree line? Is it just going to be like Fallout and it's just a wasteland before them? And I was going to be so sad if that's the way it ended. But thankfully it doesn't. They find, the promised Neverland, quote unquote, before them. And they get to like look out into the sunrise and see this new world ahead of them with like the caption of like January 15th, 15 children escaped from the Gracefield house.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's pretty satisfying. I mean, look, if you've been into the Promised Neverland since it started, this is, I hope, satisfying to you as like, you know, a conclusion to all the effort that's taken place over the past 36 chapters leading up to this point. You can't say that this was an easy, like, you know, get for them or anything like that. There's a lot of tension, and I'm really, really excited to see what happens with the story from here, because there's no way it can be the same story anymore.
Right.
Something, like, it's now going to change in some huge fashion, you know. It's not a series that really can spin its wheels, so, you know, who knows what happens next week? Do we time skip? Do we show the struggles of them trying to live in this new world? Do we immediately just jump to the idea of them trying to save the kids that were in there? You know, what happens essentially is all the questions I have, and I'm really excited for it. This was a fantastic chapter. There's no way to kind of put any other way of phrasing it. This is an amazing chapter, and this is an amazing series. So Boruto hung out with the stupid kid for like six pages or so, and traded cards with him, I think.
It's obviously, you know, a reference to when Naruto had to hang out with Konohamaru in the first series. The lesson the kid learns to, you know, kind of stand up on his own two feet. Boruto teaches him how to throw shuriken and stuff. They actually become good friends instead of the kid having to buy him. And the main purpose of this whole thing was because we spent, you know, 10 chapters to this point seeing Boruto become the character he's going to be for the rest of the series, and I think that this was kind of just an introduction to who he actually is going to be going forward.
Hmm.
Which is, I appreciate, but still, it was kind of a pretty long chapter with not a whole lot happening up until we learned that there's a butler who is actually the boss of a gang that's going to be trying to, like, do some stuff, and that's it.
I actually like a lot what this chapter intent, like, did. Like, I do like that Naruto basically, like, went to go teach him how to, like, be a little bit of a ninja. And he's like, hey, you know, like, if you had to stop, you had to stop. But they keep trying because you are getting closer. And, like, you should keep going until you get to, like, you actually accomplish it. Because if your effort...
Don't be a fucking cheating quitter like I was.
Yeah, don't be a big goober like I did.
Don't embarrass yourself in front of the entire goddamn village like I did.
So I do like it to that extent. I think one of the issues that kind of came up to me, though, is that I didn't even realize there was a butler. Like, a butler just showed up and was just like, oh, master, whatever your name is, what are you doing? And I'm like, I know that there was that same sort of character with Ibitsu in, you know, the original series with Konohamaru, but Ibitsu was kind of, like, established earlier in the chapter. And that, like, relevancy kind of felt a bit more important, whereas this dude just shows up in the middle of the train and is just like, what's going on here? And it's like, okay, I guess you're a character now, and you're evil? Holy shit.
I was evil the whole time.
You thought when you met me 12 pages ago that I was a good guy, but it turns out I'm a dickhead. It's like, alright.
Seven Deadly Sins.
Yeah, Seven Deadly Sins. 216 Deadly Sins Unite. So,
the Deadly Sins Unite!
Credits. Yeah, we are out of that flashback now, and we get a little bit of a fallout for things. Nicely, King and Diana address the fact that she now has her memories back, and they are in love, and they are willing to admit that. And, that Gowther, you know, Diana sticks up for Gowther saying, like, he gave me his memories back. And I don't think either one of the Gowthers that we met are bad guys. King essentially gets his wings. He gets, like baby fucking butterfly wings to the point where I'm like, this seems like a bit inconvenience more than anything else. Like,
every time the king gets his dick up, he gets his wings.
I'm like, uh-oh. This is the first time. How long have you been hanging around? This is the only time? And we get one other little piece of things, in reference to Oslo, the feral hound that's kind of, been always around these characters. It's actually turns out it's the reincarnation of, what's his name? Low, sorry. I thought it was more of a name than that. Low, who came back saying, you know, when he was in that thing, he's like, hey, you know, my next life, I'll protect you no matter what. So the big, you know, fangy, stupid dog, Oslo, is, Low in a reincarnated state, and he's there to protect.
Do you want to go to it?
I do like that. One, they didn't go the weird route of being like, that dog wants to hump you or something like that. But just the idea that...
Very easily. Heroes off in the corner being like, waste of a good opportunity, man!
Like, dude, you have a perfectly good fetish to exploit.
Look at that tongue! You could have it licking your feet for some reason.
But I do less like the idea of, like, you know, that love of one person for another being, like, reincarnated and, like, the loyalty of a dog is kind of like a sweet sentiment. And they all have their moments, and, you know, Diane says, hey, we gotta get going, cause we're the seven deadly sins, and we have to gather together. And they remember, Diane specifically remembers that, Gowther at that time in the flashback, you know, begged her to please lead me down the right path. So they are off, cut over to the west, where the rest of the sins are. The king had another vision, Merlin explains to them. Which I don't feel like explaining the whole thing. It essentially ends with, like, and the seven deadly sins will once again reunite. Cut to, smash, Diane and King plummet out of the fucking sky, and ta-da, everyone's back together. The seven deadly sins have reunited, and it feels so good.
Yeah. I am pleased that, you know, for now at least, it seems as though the giant tease of the Diane King relationship has finally actually come to a close, and it's like, yes, they're just fucking together. Fine, here, mm-hmm. Here, have it. Because I was getting kind of sick of that. I was like, they love each other, but memories erase her again.
Oh no!
So, I mean, that's one of the things that I feel like this series does well, is actually like progressing relationships. So to see that big one happen is very nice.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. I mean, other than that, you know, there's a couple of nice little notes, but it's, it does actually feel like, okay, yeah, let's get back to the main story now. This is a nice little character focus for these two for a bit, but let's have them fight armies again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. Let's go over to Black Clover. Page 108, The Uncrowned Undefeated Lioness, which focuses on the new Crimson Lion King's captain, who is tearing into her squad because they came to fifth. And she's really pissed off. You know, she's like, oh, that idiot Fuego Leon. You know, he raised you all to be such idiots. You guys have just been sitting on your asses. That moron is not fit to be a captain. And Leo immediately gets pissed off. He's like, no, Fuego Leon's a better captain than anybody. And all the other troops are like, yeah, he treated us really strictly and warmly. And Leo says, even if it's you, sister, I won't forgive anyone who talks about Fuego Leon like that. And she punches his face in again. She's very violent, isn't she?
A lot of people were really, enamored with this chapter because they really dig this character. I'll save my thoughts for the end here.
Okay. So she punches his face and is like, alright, then do more than just talk. You should prove it with your own power. Because that imbecile will never die and abandon you or this country until he returns. Show me the strength of the Crimson Lion Kings. And I was like, yeah. And, then she says, alright, now we're going to Hot Spring Training Camp. And, so Asta and Yuno, of course, are still just right around the corner. Sorry, Asta and Robo, you know. Because he gives a go like, things are happening here.
Beep boop.
Oh. Personality.exe not found.
He's like, that does sound like a thing humans would find fun and enjoyable.
Asta's like, a hot spring? What's that? And he was like, accessing information.
He's like, hot springs used to bathe human bodies to take out dead skin tissue and rejuvenate the body with warm heat and water, often used as comedic plot in anime to have saucy fan service.
That sounds like a fun training camp. Answer. Yes, Asta. It does sound fun.
It does sound like a very human fun thing to do.
So, all of a sudden, fucking, what's her, has her name even been fucking said yet at this point?
I think they did mention it when she was, like, the rankings were announced.
Well, the captain says, oh, you think it sounds fun, huh? And she reaches out with a fucking flaming lion claw and grabs Asta, and he's like, so then you're coming then. And Leo's like, oh, hey, Asta, alright, you come along as my rival. And Asta's like, no! But you just said it sounded fun. Why are you so upset? You know, like, Asta, I will see you later.
Peace, bro. <Goodbye.
laughs> And she reaches out with another lion claw. No, you're coming too.
And Yuno gets what may be my only legitimate laugh I've ever gotten out of this character, which is a fourth wall breaking moment where he's just like, but I'm not supposed to be this kind of character who gets, I'm not supposed to be the butt monkey. I'm not supposed to get shit on. Others are supposed to get shit on around me, and I blank-faced stare at them while it happens. As I was doing in the preceding panel.
Leo finally gives a big proper introduction to the captain, which is, she has no interest in war or politics, so she stayed out of the public eye. The hidden yet terrifying mage. Once she starts fighting, she's probably stronger than my brother, the uncrowned, undefeated lioness. Mario Leone. What an unfortunate goddamn name.
What is Mario?
I don't know. I'm just gonna call her Leona because fuck it.
It must mean something. The same way that Fuego Leon is like Fire Lion in Spanish or whatever. It must be something.
Hang on.
I'll look it up. You continue on because we've still got the stuff we have to finish up. We got like 20 minutes to get through One Piece as well.
One Piece, right. So she's gonna take them along. We cut to a meeting of the captains. Yami is obviously in a really good mood. Look at you guys who placed over the me. Aqua Deer Guy is just like,
hey, Yami's been really great. You know, I've only been in last place once, and it's tearing me up inside, but Yami's always been in last place, but he never looked like it bothered him. And Yami's like, yeah. I was like, yeah. Nice. And Dorothy is just kind of like, and Yami's like, I don't know what you're saying. She's not saying anything. She's sleeping. Like, come on. Like, leave her alone.
The only thing I could find is it is a Latin verb meaning, like, to earn. Or, like I'm earning, like, to earn a living or something like that. So.
So, Leona shows up with Asta and Yuno still in her fire paws. And Yami refers to her as Cisco Leon because she's the sister of Fico Leon. So, and Yami like, just points at us and is like, ha ha, she caught you. And Leona's just like, you're coming too. What? Fucking Charlotte is thinking to herself quietly, ha ha ha, serves him right. She goes, you too. What?
It's
and then, like Noelle, a... and then Noelle's just like, hey, come on, Dorksta. You should say goodbye to Kahono Kyoto properly. Also, the fact that our brigade came in second wasn't specifically thanks to you or anything. You're coming too. What? And just carts them all off from their fire paws.
I'm glad it doesn't hurt.
It really fire lion paws. It's like, no, it's just kind of like being, you know.
Into their hair, too, for most of them.
It's a very, like, I guess because she's got such a, I don't know. Charlotte didn't do anything. She was just there. So all these characters are being pulled off to the Hot Springs training camp, which... it turns out to be in the strong magic region, Yultim Volcano Trail. And, yeah, there's lava everywhere.
And she screams at them, calls them imbeciles.
Yeah.
So, how did you like this chapter, Nick?
I'm not really sure.
I can see why people like this character.
I like the gag on a surface level where she, you know, she's just like, oh, you want to come too? Then you're coming. And then Yuno tries to get away. You're coming too. And then Yami laughs. Yes, laughs. And then she's like, you're coming too. And then she just gets like, she's like, and you. Just fucking takes them all and like just five different paws just going on. That's a funny thing.
It almost reaches the point where it, like the people she's taking along don't even seem to make sense anymore. Like it was people like she was just like, vaguely just talking to people in her direction.
She's just like, you're not an important character, takes Rebecca too.
It like flings her into the sky like Team Rocket. I'm like, thank you.
But on the other hand, she's kind of an asshole.
I mean, she's a funny asshole, I guess, in that way. I
don't know if she is funny.
Well, here's the thing. I know a lot of people really enjoyed this chapter, because this is like a very, like, animated character. People were able to get into it. I don't know why. I wasn't able to get into this character very much, and I think it's because, like, her big thing is screaming and yelling, and I'm like, I get so much of that from Asta already. Like, I need some other personality for me to get behind at this point, because people who scream and yell and are, like, not, like, I was almost counting. I was like, how many panels are people screaming and yelling in this chapter? And it is, like, nonstop. I was like, no, I need someone with a fucking chill in this series. Somebody who's just able to mellow out.
I guess I kind of get your point, because you need a bunch of different personalities to bounce off of each other. So what's the point of putting Asta against someone who is super intense as well?
I could see definitely, and this is what the second chapter she's been in, so there's time to develop her. I may honestly learn to like this character a whole lot. It was just in this chapter, I was just like, man, I really need somebody who just brings it down a lot.
I don't know. I think I just kind of have this problem with, you know, Leo's trying to be a good person and she's just fucking punching him in the face for speaking back to her. Like, you know.
Yeah,
it's
but
not a good sibling relationship.
It is. I think the only thing that was really weird to me about that is, cause I get the idea she's like a boot camp instructor and the idea being like, you're just a physical, like, kind of guy, like, person who gets the most out of your recruits and violence isn't like something you're going to avoid. But I definitely do kind of have like a moment where I was like, I am a little bit annoyed that they were like, oh yeah, and she's definitely stronger than Fuego Leon. I was like, I kind of liked Fuego Leon. And like,
he's cool.
He's like low key getting shit on right now.
He's not even there to defend himself.
But you know what I am excited about this is that it is answering one of my concerns I had just a few chapters ago where I was like, these, you know, different captains don't seem to mean anything because we don't get much focus on them. But this does seem to be at least something that's going to give us focus not only on Meliolona or Meliolona or Meliolona, Fire Lioness, whatever fucking thing, but we're also going to get more on Charlotte, is her name? The Blue Rose chick?
Yes, yes.
I wanted to feel like it was something more fancy than Charlotte, but yeah. So it's nice that we're going to get, at least it looks like, a little bit more focus on those two as well. And hopefully we can start expanding this, like, this group of magic captains to, like, get more of an idea of what they're all like.
Yes.
All right. I think we're ready to wrap this up.
One Piece. Let's do it. The Vince Vilk Massacre Plot, Chapter 864. Last time... Charlotte was getting ready to attack Jinbei because he had just declared his loyalty to Luffy, and Brook had, in a very obvious Luffy scarecrow mask, broken the portrait of Mother Caramel. So...
Caramel?
It's spelled like caramel,
but
that's
it's
the only reason.
Okay.
That's the only reason I'm pronouncing
where,
it as caramel.
Where, okay, because if the word came up, you're like, hey, what's in the Milky Way? You're caramel. Like, well, chocolate, nougat. Caramel, right?
Yes.
Okay, we're good. Yes. All right, Nick and I can still be roommates. Woohoo!
I will say, caramel is, like, more fun to say, if that
no,
makes sense.
No, there's no way. Caramel flows. That's a caramel, sexy word.
Caramel is correct, but caramel is fun, is what
no,
I'm saying.
No, caramel is what they serve you at, like, disgusting state fairs with, like, hillbillies
only,
with two teeth. It's like, you want some of this caramel corn?
The only people who are allowed to say caramel are, like, in Louisiana. That's, like, yeah. It.
But, like, a sultry French...
You want some caramel?
Like, you want some of this caramel candy? And then, like, there you go. That's point proven down the line.
So,
Oh, Nick, we can't have Jeff on the show anymore. He just said caramel all the way. This is weird. I'm going to stay out of this.
So, Brook reveals himself, and everyone's like, oh my god, he ripped the skin off of his face! And Brook's like, no! This is my face! And Charlotte's like, wait a minute, Soul King, I thought you were dead! Brook's like, well yeah, but I died a long time ago. So, all of the people at the party are like, oh my god, Mother Caramel's portrait has been broken, what's going to happen? And Charles like, do you have any idea? Oh, and my poor cake! And everyone's like, oh my god, she's gonna blow, basically. And everyone in the Alliance is getting ready to react once she freaks out. But then people are... distracted. We cut over briefly to where Sanji and Pudding are, because Pudding is like, look, Sanji, it's my true nature. Look, see, aren't you disgusted, disillusioned? Well, you'll die soon though, and I've fooled plenty of people before just like this. And Sanji says, have you fooled yourself though, Pudding?
Yeah,
he was just waiting for that line, wasn't he?
So there's been another, like, controversy essentially over this chapter that I've seen where some people are like, oh, so not only is Pudding not evil that Sanji has to explain to her, like, no, you don't realize you're not evil. And I've seen where people have been coming saying from, like, it's like Sanji mansplaining your, like, her actual morality to her. I can see the evidence of it. I don't necessarily think that's not, like, my, like, interpretation of it, but I was actually really disappointed by this because I've come to expect more from Oda as a writer, and this is a really lazy thing that I usually didn't kind of attribute him to doing, that notion of,
it also,
like, this feels like it was the easy way out.
Pudding also seemed like she would have been much more interesting if she had just stuck to being evil, like...
Like the way
I was getting really into her character when she was this, you know, devious, you know, trusted soldier for mom, and now it's just like, oh, she is the princess we must save in this arc.
It's just one of those things where the thing I always like about One Piece and what I used to always kind of tout about it is that it was never something you could predict. It usually would defy your expectations for, at least if you were following like the general rules of shonen, it would usually throw some kind of twist in there to shake things up at least a little bit. And that's kind of what I think did happen when they were like, oh, Pudding's evil. Like, it's not this, like, nice character who's shown up that Sanji is going to marry, but it's a like, no, she's super evil. And I wish, like, I'm kind of hoping that maybe we still get to the end and maybe she isn't evil. Like, she isn't good and she is super evil. That'd be great. But I just feel like this is, like, a slightly disappointing kind of conclusion to get to of, like, no, she is good and Sanji's gonna, like, talk her into being good. It's fine that that's the conclusion to it. Like, you know, Sanji's had nice relationships with former opponents in the past, like Blitzer 2 and things like that. But I just kind of hope for a little bit more out of this. Like, this seems to be building to what's going to be a shockingly unsurprising conclusion, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So, Pudding is kind of hesitant at this point, so her older brother, Daifuku, who is the Minister of Beans, gets in and knocks her aside. I will say, I really do like the thing that Daifuku's got going on here, because essentially, his devil fruit makes him the lamp for a genie that he has to fight alongside him. So he's, you know, got this freaking glaive-wielding oni coming out of a smoke stream, coming out of his belly. It's a cool thing.
Can I point out something here too? I think this is awesome, but Oda's also started to do this recently that's annoyed me, where he does like a montage of cool like fucking powers that don't show up again. And I hope this isn't what this is, because this dude's power is awesome, but like,
it's great, yeah.
I hope we get more than this at some point down the line, because this seems like a cool power.
Well, he's going to have a fight with, he's the Minister of Beans, Chris, so he's a major opponent in the army, so he's going to have an extended fight with Sanji, presumably.
I was like, isn't there like 12 fucking ministers here already?
Shush.
So, he could definitely show up later on, but I am sitting there just like, I hope this isn't like, what was her name? The one girl from Dressrosa who had the ability to make her tears into whales and never, like, it just didn't show up again Viola. After she revealed it.
Viola.
Yeah.
Well, she didn't do that because she joined the Straw Hats after that.
Yeah, but she never used her whale tear power again at all.
Well, yeah, because then she became a good, you know, a good
She could use it for good reasons. I'm just saying, you revealed a character had the ability to turn her tears into whales.
She is a good aligned woman in One Piece, therefore she doesn't get to do anything.
I just want to see her whale tear power again.
Whale tear. We cut around to a whole bunch of stuff going on. Caesar Clown, you know, floating around inside the mirror world. Charlotte is still kind of frozen up, freaking out. And then Beige suddenly grabs Luffy and pulls him down. He's like, I'm supposed to be in charge of security, so, you know, I've got to, you know, like, keep appearances until our opportunity actually fucking arises. And, someone is like, oh, good job, Paige, kill him! And Paige is like, that actually might not be a bad idea. So, Jinbei and Paige and Luffy are trying to communicate what the hell is going on. Things are being dragged out longer and longer than they thought, were by this point, because, Charlotte still has not freaked out and frozen everyone yet. Pedro is having difficulty going up against the Minister of Baking, who is making his sword really powerful. He's a bake man with the hee hee fruit power, which, you know, means he's just kind of just like, you know, fire, but not fire, whatever. Brook's head gets knocked off. He's okay, obviously. And they're like, what the fuck's going on? Because then the Vinsmokes are being held at gunpoint, and I really love the way that this goes down, because Dredge is like, how can you do this? And all of his sons are just kind of like, ha, looks like we're in trouble now. They're just kind of like chuckling to each other. Yeah, and we don't even have our weapons. We're in deep shit. And Rage is like, well, yeah, Dad, of course they're not really freaking out because you took their emotions away. Dog. And Judge is like, oh, I can't believe this is happening. And Newsbird guy is like, this is big news! Judge demands an explanation from Big Mom, who is still freaking out. Oh, wedding cake! Oh, the Straw Hat Crew! Oh, Mother's picture! The conclusion that they draw from this is, she doesn't really know what to be angry at, because so much stuff has happened so quickly she can't focus on anything, and thus unleash her wrath about it, which is a,
I didn't know you could get angry that way,
but whatever. So they're thinking like, oh, maybe we should like, you know, grab the picture and show her the shattered portrait again. But then Beige is like, oh, hang on a second. Stop. Cause he looks over at Katakuri and he's like, Katakuri's looking really pale over there. Meaning he's seeing a future of impending disaster. And, yeah. So he says to everyone, okay, equip your invisible Symphonia systems. And some people are like, what are they talking about? Invisible Symphonia systems. And Choppy's like, that means earplugs. Oh, okay. Invisible Symphonia.
Why did you say it then?
So Katakuri shouts over to Beige and tells him to shoot Luffy right away. Beige, of course, refuses. And, Beige says, you can see a bit into the future. That's all. But that ain't some special privilege. Everyone has an equal right to change the future. End of chapter.
I like definitely the end of this chapter a lot. I like that, we're getting the idea that Beige is like a very significant player in all this and that the supernovas are going to be an important group of characters and not like, hey, Kid and Law are important from this group and the rest of them are just like, yeah, and like the rest of them are just like people around or whatever. Like I like the idea that they're all going to be big players and things to come. So I like a lot that we're getting a lot from Beige here and seeing a bit more of him. He's developed quite a dynamic personality. I like things. I'm excited to see where this element of like seeing into the future goes into, but overall, well, not my favorite.
You have to wait another week.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
Come on, Oda. You just had a week off.
Yeah. Is it off next week?
It's off next week.
Didn't say it is at the end of the chapter or the end of the magazine. Unless something unplanned happened.
I thought it was. Okay. Maybe I'm getting confused with the announcement from, earlier. I don't know. I thought it was.
Doesn't seem to be, but there's always something. It might have happened after the magazine got printed, so.
So, I don't know. I was kind of disappointed by this chapter because, like, I wasn't really expecting there to be more build-up after the last chapter, but I guess that's where they were going. And, you know, it sort of just seemed like just a quick little, hey, here's a couple more characters that are in Big Mom's group that we could have introduced before, but whatever.
Well, I think the one thing to keep in mind for the Big Mom stuff, and, you know, kind of goes to what I was saying before, I don't think this is the arc that ends their conflict with Big Mom. I think there's going to be another arc that actually deals with, like, a full-on confrontation later on. And introducing these characters now at least gives them...
No, man, those poison bazookas are going to work.
Yeah. She's totes dead. All right. So let's wrap this up with our weekly MVPs.
Series of the week, Promised Neverland. Character of the week, Isabella.
It's the exact same for me. And the Promised Neverland won our poll as well.
There were very
good chapters this week in a lot of the series that we recap. But this Promised Neverland chapter was hugely significant for the series as a whole. So I had to give it.
And I also put up a straw poll for the episode that I did with Tekking, and Promised Neverland won that one as well. So yeah,
I hope people are saying the poll's rigged just because Black Clover didn't win.
Rigged. How dare you not choose as your MVP?
Mario Lion.
So that is going to do it for Week of Manga Recap this week. We want to thank everyone for joining us here on smashcast.tv/RLOT. If you go to hitbox.tv/RLOT, it will still forward you to the new website. And, of course, you can still check us out on twitch.tv/RLOT as well. We record the show normally Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If something changes, follow us on social media. We'll keep you updated. The official podcast Twitter account is at WMR Podcast, and your hosts are at Rolo T and at Y Roller of Time. I guess I'll go ahead and say that we're going to do something a bit different.
Ooh, next time. Actually, real quick, just a special thanks to Bass Forever, who is our newest Patreon supporter. Special thanks to you, best supporter.
Patreon.com/weeklymongerrecap. We do all sorts of fun things with the support that you guys offer us, which we are very grateful for.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, we...
One of the recent goals we had was, upon reaching it, we were going to start doing more Troll OT trivia episodes, and I can tell you the groundwork has started on the next episode of that. It'll take a little bit of time. There's a lot that goes into these, but, we are working on one now, so we'll have some stuff coming up very soon that I think you guys will really dig.
Yep. I'll go ahead and announce what we're going to do for next time, but I will also say that, if you want to send us an idea for a manga to cover on the show, ask us questions for us to answer on our Q&A episode, or, you know, even just to offer a bit of feedback, you can send that stuff to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. And, one of those suggestions that we got was for something that was a bit different. It's not actually a manga or a manhwa, but, okay, I saw the idea and I was like, close enough. So those of you who are, keeping up with the anime and manga news world, about 7 years ago might remember a controversy that got kicked up, by Gene Simmons' son, when he decided to trace over a bunch of other people's artwork and sell it as his own comic book. And we are going to, be actually reviewing that, the very, 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 very short-lived comic series Incarnate. There's only 3 issues to read, so I think that we'll be ready to talk about that next time.
Yes, we'll be able to talk about that next week, and, oh man, that's gonna be a fun one.
It's gonna be a weird one.
It's gonna be a unique episode, I think. Unique review for that. So,
yeah.
Stay tuned. Anything you wanna say before we head out here?
No, just thanks to Steve Mann and to Infamous Planet as usual. Thanks for your help on everything, guys.
Yeah, and special thanks to Steve Mann for making it look like I'm a weird pervert every time I go onto Twitter, cause inevitably every time I get into Twitter, he posts up some new super naked chick getting like triple dildoed or whatever, and I'm just like, dude, how is it like every time? Twitter, this is not a top tweet I missed. I love Steve Mann's art, but for the love of God, people can see what I'm doing.
But you liked some of his other tweets, so you must have had
But don't put this at the top of my timeline when it happened 7 hours ago. They're like, no, you need to know.
It's in case you missed it, Chris.
I'm like, no.